This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. Due to popular demand, I'll be offering the live webinar on postmodernism again on Saturday, November 18th at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. It's called What is Postmodernism? To register for it, go to ThaddeusRussell.com. This week's guest is someone I thought I would never meet, a Hollywood person who I can really talk to. Moshe Kasher is a phenomenally talented comedian and actor, but he's also a first-rate thinker, and his personal history is simply amazing. Moshe and Natasha Leggero, who are married, will be taping a stand-up special for Netflix in Austin, Texas on November 29th. But right now, you need to listen to this. So about 4 or 5 years ago, I got an email from this guy named Moshe Kasher, who was a comedian, asking me to do a show with him at the UCB Theater, which is this legendary comedy theater in LA. And I sort of had heard of him a little bit, and I thought, why would I do a show, a comedy show with a real comedian on a stage? Because I'm just a professor. I was teaching at Occidental at the time. And it ended up being this panel with me and Moshe and two other comedians, and talking about my book, Renegade History of the United States. So it was really an honor. But the thing that happened that was really striking to me, the thing that I actually think about more than anything else about that night, was that right before it started, we were backstage and Moshe said, hold on a second, let me just go fuck with these people for a minute. And he walked out on stage and I watched from backstage and I just saw this energy, this force. This guy just took control of the room and held it for the entire show. And when I was on stage, I had never experienced this thing. I'm a lifelong fan of stand-up comedy, but I just felt like being next to these comedians, especially Moshe, I described it to my girlfriend afterward. It was like standing next to a jet engine. Just felt this force coming out of these guys of comedy that I just couldn't imagine ever summoning myself. Then afterward, I found out that Moshe and I were from the same hometown, basically, and had a lot of similarities, striking similarities in our childhoods. And so I've been wanting to have him on this podcast ever since I started it. So thank God I'm sitting in his amazing home in Silver Lake, Los Angeles right now, and we're about to get into it. Moshe, thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks, man. I'm getting ready to take control of this room, my living room.
You better, yeah. So, your talent is almost scary to be around.
Jeez, thanks. This is nice. I remember that night too. I remember Greg Proop saying how he was just really struck with how right on he thought you were.
Yeah, that's because Greg didn't hear the whole story.
Yeah, well, what's the rest of the story?
Well, I mean, there's certain things. I mean, you and Greg are lefties, basically, and
oh, we didn't hear your more like against the lefty grain
right.
positionings. Well, right. I luckily am probably not as down the middle left as Greg is.
Yeah, that's another reason you're here. or I'm here, I guess. But yeah, so you wrote a book, a memoir, about growing up in Oakland, your childhood. You are 14 years younger than I am, but, and there's some other clear dissimilarities between us, but there are some things that are striking in how similar our childhoods were. So first of all, you grew up in North Oakland, the Rockridge area.
Yeah.
Which is near the Berkeley border. I grew up in Berkeley. However, and you don't know this, for 3 years, right after my parents were divorced, when I was from 5 to 8, we lived on Harwood Street, which is right where you were, right near where you were, right near Claremont Middle School, where you went to school.
That's where I went, yeah.
I went to Chabot Elementary School.
I went to Chabot Elementary.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay, that's not in your book. You talk about...
For the podcast listeners home, we're stroking each other off right now.
Totally.
Just so you can get a picture.
Just wait for the money shot. Yeah, I went to Chabot Elementary School. Bad time in my life. So you went to Claremont, and those schools are about 4 blocks from each other. I also went to Peralta.
That was a year-round school.
Yep.
That's right. Chabot Elementary, I remember one night we stole a bunch of... somebody broke into a car and stole some volatile, flammable chemicals. I don't know how they got their hands on this, but do you remember there used to be a multi-story, like 100-foot-long stone slide at Chabot Elementary? Do you remember this?
Wow. I remember one of those at Cordonesi's Park in Berkeley.
They had one there as well. And okay. I have stories about Cordonesi's Park as well.
Right.
But we stole some volatile flammable chemicals and we poured it down this like super long stone slide. This is like, I guess, when you could still get away with having stone slides before we became so litigious that no one could have any fun any longer. And we poured these chemicals down the slide and lit it on fire, and a wall of flame that, I mean, I was 12, so maybe it wasn't 100 feet tall, but it felt 100 feet tall. But it was tall enough of a slide of flame that the police came like hours later. We were all on acid in the grassy field above Chabot.
At 12 years old.
Yeah.
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 Right.
We were really into chemicals, both flammable and psychedelic. And the police came, and I remember they turned the spotlight on us. We were all laying in a circle in the grassy field, and they said, they were like, we have a report of someone playing with a flamethrower here. And it was like the funniest, just the fact that the cops were it was such Keystone Cop bungling bullshit. I remember just a circle of us on acid laughing at full volume at the Oakland police officer. We were like, yeah, there was a guy with a flamethrower here, but he just left.
So one of the differences between us is that you were a hardcore juvenile delinquent.
That is true.
I was not. I became an adult delinquent, but I was not a delinquent then. I wish I had been. But one of the things we do have in common is that at Peralta, in fact, Peralta was probably 80% black, something like that. It was certainly predominantly black. And I was the white, nerdy kid with the weirdo, atheist, communist parents. And so I would walk into Peralta every day and start talking about how God didn't exist.
Uh-huh, sure.
And then proceed to get a beat down.
Yeah.
Which I think happened to you as well. Similar things.
Not around atheism, though.
Right, know? No. Right, no. Just about around being Jewish.
Just, or, yeah, I would say Santa doesn't exist. God might exist, but the Santa Claus character and...
And here's the thing, just being white.
Sure. Or pick... Yeah, I mean, look, in Oakland, I mean, I'm sure it's the same thing in the over the Berkeley border. Is like, as I say in the book, like there were different you had choices if you were white. In order to, like, the popular kids were black. Like, the Letterman jacket was replaced with a starter jacket. And it was like, if you were a black dude, like, that, you're already vibrating at a different social level than any white person could. But then within the white world, there were, like, different kinds of white people. There were white people that acted black. But then there were nuanced black acting white people. There were white people that were black. So this is a distinction I think few people know. It's like there were white people that were born into black neighborhoods and that were like really just basically ostensibly they were black people.
So like Paul Wall in Houston.
Yes, Paul Wall would be a great example of an actual black white guy. Then there's Rachel Dolezal, right, who is a white person that
different
that thinks she's black.
Yeah, that's
not what we're talking about.
Paul Wall, if anyone is unaware of this genius of a person who I've been a fan of for a long time. So I saw Paul Wall's videos many years ago when he first became big, and I watched probably 3 or 4 videos of his before I realized that he is technically, according to American standards, a Caucasian.
Wait, you watched him rapping and thought he was black?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that is a heavy magic that he has cast upon you.
I mean, sure. I mean, well,
he's as white as you get.
Well, there are black people with skin that color or close to that color.
Paul Wall is unmistakably a white boy.
When you have a grill, a full gold grill, and
right.
I mean, it's...
Well, that's his thing, is that he started off making grills for all the rappers and then turned into a rapper himself. So Paul Wall's perfect example of a guy that's like from the ghetto, so has so much black cred, the distinction is has no white friends. Then there's the next strata, which of white person that acts black, but exclusively to his other black acting white friends. No, maybe one black friend, but truly his social circle is all white, but they all think they're black.
Right. So then, that person code switches, you mean? They're bilingual, they go back and forth?
I wouldn't call it code. I would say calling it code switching gives it a little bit too much respect. I would do that, by the way. That was me.
I know.
Growing up, that was me. I would be talking to my brother, and he, you know, he went a different route with our set of circumstances, which were at times somewhat dire. We were very poor, and we were raised very, very poor. My parents were disabled, and I'm sure we're going to get into that. But he went the other direction, which is the third strata, which is white people that just try to stay in their little white zone and do really well in school and get out of Oakland public schools and find a way. Like, we were poor, but he got into college prep, CPS, which was like a really fancy bougie high school. And he went to a mini Ivy League. He went to Wesleyan. And he just, he got his way out of Oakland circumstances, through academic willpower.
And he was never interested in black culture the way that you were.
No, that wasn't a thing for him.
Right.
So that was one zone he could go, but I'd be talking to him at home, and I, of course, know him because we grew up together and we share some DNA. Then I would be talking like my regular self, maybe a little bit cooler than I'm talking now because I'm a little older now, but blah, blah, blah. The phone would ring. So I'd be like, yes, David. Well, I mean, I didn't quite talk like a little Prescott boy, but like, you know, David, do. And then the phone would ring and I'd be like, hello? Hell yeah. What's up? Okay, player. All right. I bet. Peace. And he would be looking at me like, who the fuck are you? Who is this creature? And I'm like, I'm just keeping it real, dog. Kind of halfway. Mm-hmm. So that was me.
And that was me too.
I describe it as, in the book, actually, I think I described it as, you know those people when you're on a bus and those white kids get on the bus and you, I actually don't even know if they exist anymore because I think that culture has kind of collapsed on itself, and I think that the difference between like black culture and white culture isn't as, it's not as stratified as it was when I was growing up, but those kids you think when they get on the bus, you go, oh, great, these fucking kids. That was us. We were those.
Oh, yeah. You described
kids.
Your little white boy delinquent gang as that, right? And it was all white kids. You were in this little gang when you were about 12 or 13.
Yeah,
I guess it's the people who set the fire at Chabot.
That's right. The pure adrenaline gangsters is what we called ourselves, literally.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
And were they all wiggers, too?
They were, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we grew into it. We grew into that.
Well, it's funny that you were all white, though, right? So you were all in this mostly black school because Claremont was a black school, mostly, right? But the few white badasses formed this gang, and they also talked black and were sort of part of black culture. And
in a weird way, we were a part of black culture that was exclusively white. So, I mean, by the way, when a black guy would come around, I mean, it's like Christmas, you know? It was just like, we were stoked. We were just like, this is the greatest, you know?
Hey, you made it.
And, but we were, I mean, this was a bizarre time for sure. We were all N-word users, liberal N-word users, but in the good way.
Mm-hmm.
With an A, not an ER.
And you would refer only to each other as nigga.
That's right. But then what's funny about a white boy that uses the N-word is that when you are only around white people, you use the N-word very liberally. Then a black dude will show up in your social circle to hang out, smoke some weed, whatever. And you really got to, like, first of all, everybody just organically stops using the word until you kind of like suss them out. You're like, are we in a world? Or if you go around a group of black dudes and then you're kind of like waiting for them to broach it, like for them to pierce the layer, if they call you the N-word, then you're like, is this, do I have a hood pass to kind of like do my thing right now? Or can I, no, okay, no, we'll just say buddy from now on.
Yeah, a hood pass is worth, you know, a brick of gold.
That's right.
When you're in our situation back then, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, we wanted nothing more than to be approved of and, well, or welcomed in by black people.
Yeah, yeah. I would say, and I think of it not so much, by the way, I think that the Bay Area is one of the most, in retrospect, one of the most racially stratified places that I've ever seen. Because, like, I just feel like, because the outward expectation was one of like progressivism and diversity, that it was almost like a diamond, you know, condensing. It just felt so tense in Oakland public schools. I felt so put upon as a white boy in Oakland public schools in a way that I just don't feel like is as true. Maybe I've made too much hay about this, but in like New York and LA, there feels like a more organic kind of diversity in New York and LA, as opposed to the Bay Area, where it just felt like there was racial tension constantly. That's how I felt anyway.
Oh, well, yeah. So this is the thing I want to unpack with you. You know, so in the book, you talk as if, and I'm not criticizing at all because I shared this experience.
Sure.
You the way you talk about your childhood in those neighborhoods and in those schools is the way that Black people who grew up in Birmingham, Alabama in the 1950s talk about their childhood and their schools and their
I feel that I was exactly as put upon as an African American youth in Birmingham in the 50s.
No, Moshe, I think actually you were, and I think I was too. And this is something that is never talked about, and I think it's really important. So we were I'm a little bit earlier than you, but I was literally the first. Berkeley Public School District was the first school district in the United States of America to impose busing.
Uh-huh.
So forced integration. So if you lived in a white neighborhood, you got bused all the way across the town to the Black neighborhood, to the school there, and so that they had perfect racial integration. So when you said that the Bay Area is racially stratified, statistically, it's the exact opposite.
That's not...
I know what you mean. Hang on. Yeah. So, so yeah, all the schools were perfectly balanced in this way. But the thing is, there was collateral damage in that. And I'm still trying to figure out my feelings about this because I always was around Black kids. So we lived in a Black neighborhood. My mother lived right next to the Ashby BART station, right on the border of Oakland. That's basically the hood in Berkeley.
Sure.
And the neighborhood was about 50 to 60% Black. I don't know. But all my friends there were Black, and Peralta was mostly Black, and always around Black people when I was a kid. The thing is, and this I saw this in your book, and I've heard you talk about this, but it's hardly anyone talks about it. So we got our asses kicked. We got mocked, made fun of simply because we were white, relentlessly assaulted in every way possible. And we were terrified of Black people, and we were absolutely inferior in that particular context. Now, when we applied to Wesleyan 10 years later, we were superior, of course, in other ways. But in that particular context, in those moments, which in childhood is the only moment that matters, we were actually the oppressed. So there's integration, tremendous integration, but there's a whole lot of white kids who are suffering mightily. And the funny thing is that you and I and some of us who are in that situation nonetheless still wanted to be Black.
So you're thinking it's Stockholm Syndrome.
I don't know what it is.
It's
but I'm
Stockholm
fascinated.
Syndrome, but with Black people in Stockholm for a change.
So yeah, I think that's funny.
That is a fascinating idea that why... Because I don't disagree with you at all that in the growing up in Oakland public schools at that time in history, I don't know what it's like now, no question about it, like you were targeted if you were white. And I mean, Hawaii, I have some friends who grew up in Hawaii. I think it's like 10 times worse in Hawaii. I mean, you're just like...
I've heard.
You are openly... Right. You are aggressed against.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, I grew up thinking and feel and knowing that was the coolest culture in the world and wanting that nothing more than to be integrated into, accepted mm-hmm. by, and approved of by Black culture.
Exactly.
It's really interesting. And it is... Maybe it is... I don't know.
It gets even weirder and deeper because think then also about your politics around race and my politics around race, certainly until very recently, but even now, you know, is that we also thought of Black people as oppressed when in fact we were being oppressed by Black people.
Yeah, but as you said off mic earlier, that every situation around privilege and oppression is all context,
right,
and it's all situational. And so I'm able to say that circumstantially... Absolutely, I was oppressed by the kids that were Black in my direct experience, and that circumstantially, certainly, I grew up in some situations of privilege that put me way beneath the learning curve. I mean, this is the ultimate argument that's online right now. How can you talk to me about white privilege? I'm a white person that grew up poor and with a drug addicted dad, and my mom was in prison, and it's like I believe that one of the mighty superpowers of a white person in America is to actually decontextualize everything and make it all about your own personal individual context, right? It's like, oh, but I can just take it all the way back to my personal individual experience. But I think like I'm capable of thinking about my circumstances in Oakland and then also, not that you're not capable of this, mm-hmm. but also then widen out the aperture a bit and go, okay, that was my circumstance and my circumstances were pretty extreme.
Yeah, but I'm talking about us as 10 and 12-year-olds, right? When we couldn't do that.
You're saying even at 10, we thought of Black Americans as oppressed.
I'm not sure. Well, you don't talk about that in your book, I don't think, about the politics of it. But yeah, I mean, because, you know, my parents were radicals. And so, and the Black Panthers headquarters was four blocks from us. Sure. And I was around that. And I got the propaganda, much of which I think is basically true, but some of it's not. But anyway, you know, I got the line.
I got to tell you, I really think the difference between you and me is that you lived in Berkeley and I lived in Oakland.
Why?
I just think Berkeley is inherently... I don't even think this. I'm going to go on record. Yeah. If there's a notary public here, oh, I'm Jewish, I automatically have a notary public license. I believe that there is a more systemically radicalized, ideologically enforced system in Berkeley and Berkeley public school system than there is in Oakland. Oakland, to me, was about... Now, I know the Panthers are from Oakland, and I know that we have a rich political history, but to me, Oakland... And it's different now, by the way, because there's Occupy Wall Street and da-da-da. When I was growing up in Oakland, Oakland's primary bent, especially in the public school system, was keeping its head above water. Mm-hmm. It was such a broke school system. There were so many murders. There was so much crime. There was so much poverty that Oakland was not... a radicalized school system, political system. I mean, let me put it to you this way. The Berkeley City Council voted to divest from Israel and censure the Iraq War.
Oh, yeah.
A city council with a foreign policy, right? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oakland Public Schools and Oakland City Council, I mean, I can only imagine was like just trying to get itself funded, you know?
Well, here's one of the differences that helps explain what you're talking about, I think. Oakland then and now, but certainly then in the 80s and 90s when you were growing up there, was run by blacks.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So the mayor for much of that time, or all of that time, certainly much of the time, was black. The city council was dominated by blacks.
Absolutely.
And here's for us, you and me, the schools were absolutely run by blacks. The principals, vice principals, most of the teachers. Mm-hmm. For me, even in Berkeley, the schools were black run. Berkeley's city government was mostly white not progressives. They were communists.
Uh-huh. Right.
And I mean, capital C communist. Gus Newport, who was the mayor when I was a kid, he was a member of the Communist Party of the United States of America.
That's interesting. You know, my grandparents were members of the Communist Party of the United States of America.
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
So, well, yeah, that's, I think that is the difference.
So,
right?
So the black town, the black city, right, is also broker, right? There's just less, you know, of everything because it's a black city. And it's, the thing is, you get stuck in this weird place where you're kind of in this black power structure, but you're sort of at the bottom of it. And so I am of the world and the culture that actually runs the place, although my parents were anti-communist Trotskyists, but whatever, you know, in terms of sort of like what we thought of socialism and black politics and all that stuff, we all shared the same thing.
Right. And I don't really remember getting any information about, I mean, in general, we were very leftist. You know, my mom is deaf. My parents are both deaf. And my mother, her primary focus in terms of diversity or identity politics, although that phrase didn't exist then, was about disability rights and was about women's stuff. So, you know, as I say, like, my mom used to take me to, you know, disability rights marches. And, you know, I have this memory of being on her shoulders at like 3 years old at a pro-choice rally. It's like, Mom, I'm fucking 3 years old. This pro-choice issue is pretty close to the bone for me. I just arrived. You know, I don't want you looking longingly at a pro-choice sign.
I worked for the Center for Independent Living.
My mother was on the board of directors of the Center for Independent Living for many, many years.
I figured.
So that's what I'm saying. That's my experience with diversity, was that it was just a de facto. And you're right, though. I mean, you're right. I have a memory. And it's one of the primary memories of my brother's life. And it wasn't as significant to me, but for him, it was truly extremely traumatic, maybe because he was older. We grew up on Piedmont Avenue. And Piedmont Avenue School was our elementary school. And it's an Oakland public school called Piedmont Avenue Elementary School. It's complicated because there's a city called Piedmont, which is blocks away, which is an even more fascinating example of a kind of a white flight without actually leaving. They created...
Right.
It's a city that created white flight without moving to the suburbs.
It's very, very wealthy, white, almost all white.
Yeah. They made a suburb...
In the middle of Oakland.
They made a suburb inside of an urban area.
Right.
It's very fascinating. Anyway, one of two...
But you didn't live in Piedmont.
I lived in Oakland on Piedmont Avenue, but it's one of the great banes of my existence. We'd go, oh, you're from Piedmont? And I'm like,
right.
Even now, I'm 38 years old. I have a wife. I live in LA for a long... I have no connection to that. And I'm still like, no, motherfucker, I'm from Oakland. It's Oakland. I'm not from Piedmont.
Yeah, that's another funny thing. You know, fuck, this still pisses me off. Like, I was always in the wrong class. So when I was little, when I was like from 5 to 12, we lived in sort of the hood, right? Uh-huh. Near the Ashby BART station, right? Not poor, but like working class, sure, for sure, and mostly black. And then, of course, my father, they were divorced, but my father moved to the hills, mm-hmm, not high up in the hills, but, you know, solid middle class, mostly white neighborhood. And so when I was little, when I was a kid and living in the hood, I was ashamed that of where I lived, and I'd have white friends and I wouldn't bring them over to my house. And you, mm-hmm, talk about being ashamed of your family and where you lived and all, absolutely, that stuff. And so I totally related to that too. So when I was, but then later when I'm in high school at Berkeley High, where everybody's, you know, of course, PC is all get out. That's when I was living with my father in the hills. And so I was ashamed of that.
Ashamed,
so I was never,
wealth.
Yeah. That's, and in Berkeley is one of these places where people are actually, it's bad to be wealthy.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so Bay Area to me that we are clinging to things. I realize that, like, I'm clinging to things even now, you know, in middle age or whatever. I don't like to refer to myself.
You're not there yet.
I'm not? Yes.
I am, but you're not.
Oh, great.
Not,
yeah. I'll get there.
You'll hopefully get there soon. Yeah.
But I just really care that you know that I'm from Oakland. It's like, why do, right, I care? But I do. I fucking do.
I know you do. I can tell. Yeah.
We're at Piedmont Avenue Elementary. It's a Saturday. My brother and I climbed the fence. It's a great big chain link fence. But if you came in where the kindergarten was, there's a little chain link fence and then another little chain link fence. And then you could have the playground all to yourself. And it was really fun. We used to sneak in there every Saturday and play basketball and, you know, just have fun. Me and my brother, we lived right down the street from that school. And we didn't have any sort of, yeah, that's where we went to go play. And one day we were in there playing. He and I was probably, I don't know, 6. And he was probably 9. Maybe I was 9 and he was, no, yeah, 6 and 9. And these two black kids came in, did the same thing. They were probably brothers too. Yeah. And they literally took us hostage,
yeah,
for probably 5 hours.
Yep.
Held us down. They had a metal baseball bat. And my brother, and they were threatening to beat me up because I was 6. And my brother was like pleading with them, you know, please don't fuck my brother up. And they were going, I remember very, this is our get back for slavery, motherfucker. They kept, mm-hmm, saying that. They made my brother kiss their shoes. Like, I remember it very clearly, like how scared, I mean, truly scared. And honestly, growing up white in the Bay Area, you were terrified when black teenagers would come around. And yet you worship them. And the whole, yeah, thing is so weird and complicated. They held us hostage for a long time. And the thing that I'm the most... my brother had a lot of shame about this for a long time because, you know, he couldn't protect me. And he had to kiss their... Literally, not an exaggeration, kiss their shoes for slavery. And I'm not sure how that retroactively...
Jewish kids, yeah.
Well, you know, yeah, 2 Jewish kids, right? You know, they want... It's 40 acres, a mule. And you know, while you're at it, kiss my shoes. Why not? But the part that was the most embarrassing and sad to me was that they broke into... they convinced us, okay, we'll let you go, but bring us to your house. I don't know why, but we were so like terrified. We like walked them back to our house so my brother could show them his prize Gary Carter rookie card that he, his prized possession, mm-hmm, and they fucking stole it. We let them in our house, mm-hmm, and they fucking stole the Gary Carter rookie card. And it was this great moment of trauma. Anyway, my brother, when he turned 40, I got him a Gary Carter rookie card for his birthday.
Is he resolved this? Is he okay now?
I think so, but it's like, it's still, I mean, he's 40 years old and it's still this like, this wound that's almost closed. But that's what race relations felt like, yep, in Oakland in the 80s and 90s.
Okay.
And that's what I meant by stratified. I didn't mean literally stratified because it was technically, physically very diverse, but it felt like the tension was so overwhelming all the time. It felt like so gross in a way that maybe I'm naive because I didn't grow up in LA and I didn't grow up in New York. It feels like things aren't as loggerhead kind of as they are in the Bay Area, but who knows?
Yeah, so I'll see your hostage situation and raise you.
Okay, great.
So my parents, one night, they were always having these meetings because the comrades had to meet to plan the revolution, and so they had a meeting at Oakland Tech High School.
So I went to Tech for about 2 months.
Yeah. My God. I mean, that is like 95% black, isn't it? I mean, yeah. That's even.
I was 95% on drugs, so I mostly didn't notice who was around me.
That's hardcore, yeah. So, and so, you know, they're having their meeting, talking about the revolution, a bunch of white socialists. And then, so my brother and I, we were about that age. We go out to play because we're bored. And it was at night. And so we go to the field, the ball field, and we're doing stuff, and the sprinklers come on, and then as a man, actually, a black man came on the field and just came up to us and said, take off your shoes. Stay here. Don't go anywhere. And we took off our shoes. He took our shoes. He threw them away. He said, yeah, now walk around in the grass. Now march for me. And there was stuff about because we're white. And it was definitely racial, political stuff going on. And we were held there and terrified for quite a while. And so that happened. And then our house got stoned by a bunch of black kids in our neighborhood who were actually friends of mine. Again, this is all so complicated and so strange. And I was routinely tortured and made fun of in all sorts of ways by black kids. But I'm like simultaneously at the same time, and you did the same thing, studying black history, black culture. I'm reading Roots, every word, under the covers with a flashlight at night. I read
you're
that
in so Berkeley, I can't
totally,
stand it, man.
Fifth grade, man. Totally. I read that whole book when I was in fifth grade under the covers with a flashlight. And knew very early that I preferred black culture to white culture.
Well, this is what I'm saying.
There is such a thing, sort of black working class culture.
Yeah, this is why I feel like actually a superpower of analytic progressivism is like you and I ought to, especially in the current contemporary political climate, we ought to be reacting against black culture and saying,
that's what I'm saying.
And have been radicalized hardcore to the right.
Exactly.
And yet I am capable of, and not, I don't think this is kudos to me or you, but it's just like, I'm capable of saying, yeah, those circumstances were really shitty. Those black kids that held us hostage, that black guy that held you, those are really bad things, probably spurned on by systemic racism, but also spurned on by just being a fucking asshole. And yet I can kind of look at it and go, well, still, I still am committed to like racial justice I'm not going to be writing articles for Breitbart.
Yeah. I mean, but in that particular context, they had all the power too, right? So not black privilege, but they certainly had, they were dominant in those moments for us.
That's what I'm saying, is like, yeah. as opposed to like a Stephen Miller, yeah. and the Breitbarts of the world, who I believe, and I'm not saying this is 100% true, because I'm sure that there are exceptions to every single rule, but most people like that become truly radicalized are not people that were born in a truly diverse exposure to people of other cultures and had negative experiences to the point that they go, I have decided actually that these people are bad people. I'm going to become radicalized. It's really people that are observing, you know, 95% of Islamophobic people are people that have zero. By the way, this statistic brought to you by fully pulled out of my asshole. But I'm just saying, most my gut feeling tells me that most people that are truly afraid of Muslims don't have exposure to Muslims.
Right.
And people that are truly, you know, talking about the welfare mama that's like sitting there grabbing all the cream off of the government's crop are not people that have real exposure to the black community. These are mostly othered, imagined, hysterical, fear-based things.
Sure, there's a lot of that, yeah. I guess the thing about our black experience is that I learned much, much later in life that, you know, after being around sort of progressive ideology, left-wing ideology all the time, is that certain things are not allowed to be said. So
yeah.
Like your experience, my experience with black people growing up and how we really suffered was never really given voice. And I think if you and I had this conversation in a college classroom right now, we'd be shut down.
People would be upset. I wonder, how could we get shut down? These are just things that happened.
Well, but you know that this...
Look, I'm not making an argument that academia is like an open channel for say what you will. We'll accept anything. But I'm just saying, these are just experiences that you... I mean, you could try to... By the way, this is the difference between you as an academic and me as a comedian. Nobody can shut me down. I could say this on stage at a comedy club if I found a way to make it funny. And nobody could shut... They could tweet about it, but that doesn't matter. I still step on stage and talk about whatever I want.
Well, so comedians are being shut down at college campuses, right?
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, isn't this true that they're not allowed on college campuses anymore? Many of them have been...
Tell me more.
Disinvited. I mean, Chris Rock has said this, that you can't...
Chris Rock has said that college crowds have become more uptight.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard of many comics saying that their tours, college campus tours, have either been canceled or they've been disinvited, or it's harder to get the gigs, right?
I don't think that's true.
Okay.
I don't think it's true that college crowds have become more uptight. That is probably true. This is what's interesting to me is like, okay, so now I will now pivot into my less left-leaning political opinions. It's like, okay, so Seinfeld and Chris Rock come out and say like, oh, these college kids are, you know, getting uptight. And by the way, I don't know why Seinfeld is worried about uptight crowds. It's not like he's out there like, I'm eating pussy like a motherfucker, right? I grew up around black people. I'm getting held hostage, eating pussy, held hostage. Racism isn't real. White privilege isn't real. That's not Seinfeld. He's not a guy that needs to worry about.
I don't think so.
But, you know, Chris Rock could be edgy, I guess. I mean, definitely.
Oh, definitely.
And these guys are, they're the best. But okay, they say that these college crowds are getting more touchy. To some degree, there's no doubt about the fact that college-aged kids in liberal arts colleges, in fancy liberal arts colleges, are getting uptight, identity politicked to death to the point that nobody wants to joke about anything, and people tweet this Larry David, the most recent Larry David thing. Did you watch his
I heard about it.
It's the fucking I was gonna say it's the most milquetoast joke ever. It is about trying to fuck women at a concentration camp, so it's not the most milquetoast joke, right? People in concentration camp, all they wanted was a little bit of milk and some toast. But it's so not a big deal to me,
right?
Me looking at the joke, I'm a Jew, I'm a stand-up comedian, I'm looking at the joke, I'm like, this is not even that edgy of a... It's edgy because it's about a concentration camp. It is an edgy joke, but it's like, when you really think about it, the joke is, Larry David says, I'm such a pervert, basically. I've always wondered if I was in the 1940s and Hitler was in power and I got sent to a concentration camp, would I still have been checking out the women, you know? And he goes, the problem is there's no good opening lines at a concentration camp. Like, so... How they treating you? That was his joke, right?
Lenny Bruce had almost the same joke, not quite, but he has a bit about like men and sexual drive. He's like, yeah, even if you get hit by a car, the guy gets hit by a car, he's in the ambulance, he'll make a pass at the nurse.
Sure.
Right. It's just no matter what the circumstances are, but who cares?
I think I had that concentration camp, punch it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Get that spice going. But anyway, people are now like, oh, he stepped over the line. It's just like people are just looking for the line and then drawing it behind what you just said. I mean, people definitely, outrage culture is fully real and fully in effect on college campus.
Well, okay, yeah. So what I was referring to was that, like, you know, I went straight into academia and I stayed there for, you know, 25 years. And it just that I left academia in particular.
Yeah.
And I became increasingly clear to me that there was a lot that was disallowed. There was a lot of silence about stuff that should be talked about.
100%.
Like my experience, your experience. And then there was just straight up dishonesty about things.
Yes.
And that's really been sort of my story. But
and I don't doubt that. And I don't doubt, I mean, not that I don't doubt that. I know that that mm-hmm. is true. I know that, I mean, I think what you're talking about, people being disinvited to college campuses, I think we're really talking about one comedian, and that's a recent example.
Really?
And that is actually Owen Benjamin.
Oh. Who got maybe the same I was talking.
Disinvited to a college campus after getting into a fight with a parent of a trans kid. And
okay.
It's a whole complicated balagan.
Well,
but
okay.
Yes, college crowds have gotten maybe a little bit more uptight. That's totally possible.
Well, do you tour colleges?
I do colleges, and I have never experienced any... The only pushback I have ever gotten on a college campus, it was from a mother at University of Miami who wrote me and the dean of students. This is actually a pretty funny story. I was opening for Aziz Ansari on the road for his full nationwide tour, right? We're doing a bus tour from like Denver, Colorado, all the way to New York City. So it's, you know, we did a bunch of dates. And we get to University of Miami, and Aziz is doing his thing. I go up, I do my thing, I got the joke. It is certainly an edgy joke. About how, you know, uptight we are around our grandparents. We all, you know, we always call our grandparents cute. I mean, the punchlines include, your grandma's not cute, she sucked your grandfather's dick. You know, it's this whole thing about how we've desexualized our grandparents mm-hmm. and called them cute, but in fact, they're just human beings who like rutted in the hay like our parents did and like we will do. And, it, you know, this blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
I get this like angry letter from this mom, super mad about like, I came to parents' weekend and suck your grandfather's dick and she's writing to, the funny part of this to me is that the guy, whoever the girl who books comedians, does not know who I am because I'm opening for Aziz, the comedian that they booked, who he's just bringing me on this nationwide tour. They don't even know I'm there, basically. They're just like, who is, like, they're looking through their records like, we have no record of this guy who just comes in and is like, your grandma sucked your grandfather's dick, and then gets off stage. I mean, it's just so funny to me. By the way, I remember the gig. It was a good gig. Yeah, I would definitely remember if I'd bombed because those kinds of memories don't leave you.
Well, okay. Have you toured campuses lately?
Yes, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're special. What year did it come out?
5 years ago, 2012.
Yeah, live in Oakland.
Yeah.
So I watched it a couple weeks ago, and one of the first things I thought was, I don't know if you could get away with this now.
There are certain jokes in my special that I would probably not tell today. Certain ones. Yeah, that's true.
You definitely, and there's like a moment where you pump, where you pound fist with a black dude in the front row.
I would do that today.
Would you?
Yes.
The way you did in that? Okay. I thought that was.
I was wearing a Ku Klux Klan hood, just to, so you guys have some context.
Holding a noose.
No, the jokes that I wouldn't tell, I know the one that you're talking about. Wait, why did I? You know what's funny about that black dude in the front row is I knew that fist bump was just a thing that had happened organically on stage over time when I would tell this one joke. I think it's a joke about wearing large condoms. Is that what it is? And then you pound the fist with a black guy, like some version of this guy knows what I'm talking about, whatever. And so it was such a nice moment that I told the audience coordinator, oh, I need a black guy to be sitting in the front row. So let's make sure that there's a black guy there. And people totally notice, because everybody notices everything on the internet, that because the way that you tape a stand-up special, I don't know if you know this, you do two tapings and you wear the same outfit and you run the same set so that you can edit back and forth in case one joke doesn't work or you flub a line or whatever it is. You kind of cut. Nobody really notices, but some people who are savvy go, it was very funny. I got a lot of emails like, you think we're not going to notice that there's two black people in the same seat in the same, you think, I don't know. The guy had dreads in one moment and then the next moment he's bald.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Anyway, but yeah, I do think that, politically,
the joke was essentially black guys have big dicks. Right?
Sure.
And it's fine. It went over. I think it went over well then. Right?
I mean, it's a bit more sophisticated than that.
Well,
for those
of course it is. But that's the bottom line of
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that's
right?
the bottom
and
line.
And so,
sure.
Right, imagine taking that clip, right? That video clip.
Yeah.
And again, playing it at Wesleyan.
Well, you want to talk about.
You're dead. Right.
Well, if you want to talk about outrage, there was a blog. This is one of the proto outrage culture blogs called Your Fave is Problematic. It's an early outrage culture blog, Tumblr blog, and before it became.
Oh, like, this was not an ironic title.
No.
Your Fave is Problematic.
No,
they meant that.
They meant it very, very sincerely, and they would basically go through and like call out the problematic behavior of celebrities, right? And they wrote a post on that special on Live in Oakland that was, I'm talking 4 pages long. I mean thing after thing after thing. And then we would like move on to like, you know, then the next post would be about like Louis C.K.'s special, and it would be like, this joke bothered me, and then moving on. And then I was like looking at Louis' special and watching it, I was like, this stuff is so much further down the edge road than me.
Oh my God, yeah.
I was wondering, like, reading that bothered me, because every time the left comes after me, it bothers me because more than when the right comes after me.
Me too. Me too.
I want them to like me or they
it's family.
But that's why they went after me. Mm-hmm. I now realize, in retrospect, the reason that they broke down thing by thing every problematic thing that I said and attacked me more robustly than Louis is because I resemble them.
Yep.
And then it hurts more when I don't actually bow in front of the like outrage gods that they've erected.
Yep.
And I still don't bow in front of those gods. But I do think that's what it is. It's like the reason that they went so hard on that special is that blog post, it had no effect on my actual life, is that they are like, here's a dude from Oakland espousing progressive principles but not espousing progressive policed language, which is what's more important.
You know what effect that has on us.
That's part of it too, right. Yeah. But even it's even shallower than that, I think. It's just like, you're like us. Why not talk like us?
You're the bad son.
And by the way, what's important, principles or language?
Huh.
I mean, making sure that you say it right or making sure that you have...
What you mean.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, one of the things I also saw in your history that I certainly see in mine is like what anthropologists call liminality.
Oh, sure.
You're always...
I have no idea what that means, but sure.
You went to a good college. Come on. It's being between, always. It's a figure or a process, or it could be a person, between two cultures or two rites of passage. You're always between. You're never of something fully. You're always going between the two things. You're kind of have one foot in one thing and another foot in the other all the time. And so you're white and black,
Right.
You're also Jewish, but your mother is secular.
And secular, yeah.
Right. And oh, by the way, we haven't mentioned this. There are no Jews in East Bay, basically, right?
Yeah.
Meaning there are a billion Jews, but they're all secular.
There's no Jewish culture,
yeah,
really. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, my whole world was secular Jews from New York.
Yeah.
But you wouldn't, but they never talked about Jewishness at all. When I moved to New York later, everybody talked about being Jewish. Like, that's the first, it's like, hello, my name is so-and-so, I'm Jewish. But anyway, so you're from that very secular, but Jewishness. And then, but your father, is living in Brooklyn, and he's not just Jewish.
He is, in fact, a religious Hasidic Jew through a strange set of increasingly religious circumstances. He fell into increasing levels of religiosity.
And just to make it all weirder, he's also deaf.
He's deaf. And by the way, to make it weirder still, I'm deaf and not deaf.
Right.
Which is the ultimate identity of a person with deaf parents, to a degree that is... I think you'd be interested in this. They're kind of interesting. I don't actually have this, but there are people a lot of people who have deaf parents who don't consider themselves technically hearing,
really?
Even though their ears work 100%, right? They consider themselves, because deafness is a disability that, as a result of necessitating a language invention, it has become a culture, right?
Sure.
So, I don't know of any other disability that is a culture.
So they're trans deaf.
It's like if you were born, they're trans deaf, except that they were born to deaf. It's almost like you're black. Your parents are black, but you were born white. And you're like, wait, literally, you came out of the vagina, the holy vagina of a black woman, you know?
Our dream, by the way.
Straight up, yes, the Berkeley dream.
God, I wish.
With a copy of Roots falling out directly afterwards, your womb sibling. And yet, you're the enemy and you're of the ally. You are, you're a super ally because you're actually a part of, it's family.
Right.
You're not hearing, but you are... So this is literally true, and I know you want to get back to the Judaism, but I think you'll love this. I've never really gotten involved in that culture, but there's a whole culture of it. They're called CODAs, Children of Deaf Adults.
Wow.
And they have annual conferences and campouts, and a lot of CODAs have a real difficult time integrating into hearing society. They have a real difficult time identifying. They're more... liminal than I am, because they truly feel... pulled apart. They don't feel a part of anything. Their linguistic skills sometimes are I would say diminished slightly, mm-hmm. because they weren't modeled, they weren't modeled in English that was robust, but they're also, they're not they're native ASL speakers, but what good does that do them? And they never feel fully at ease with themselves in either culture, and to the degree that the one and only CODA thing I've done is I was a sign language interpreter for many, many years, and there was an annual continuing educational conference of the Registry of Interpreters for the Deaf, and there was a meeting, a CODA interpreters meeting, and this is one of the least comfortable situations I have ever experienced. Although to all of my CODA brothers and sisters, I know no judgment, I love you, but they stood on stage and they got up on the table. These CODAs, when they would talk in a deaf voice.
Oh, no.
For straight up. And it's a thing that they do where they will, that is like they will code switch on a degree that that's hardcore code switching. They're code switching to a speech impediment.
Yeah, that's next level shit.
It's like hardcore. It would literally be like, brothers, sisters, everybody gather around. It's time for the CODA. And I'm like sitting there like, oh my God. I'm like, this is like deep cringe. So that's as between as you can get right there.
This is recent?
This is contemporary, and it was my time going there recent. This is probably 10 years ago.
So it's completely consistent with all other identity politics, though, right? I mean, there is a particular language and particular way of talking among deaf people, and it's a culture. It's its own culture.
Absolutely, but I wouldn't call it identity politics when it comes to CODAs, because... like I said, the weird part about CODAs, it actually, in a weird way, is the progressive, like, identity politic woke person's dream, which is that, no, you're actually, it's like being a straight white man, but you actually are a part of the black, gay, trans community. Like, you really are.
Oh.
You know, you aren't just like an ally on the outside. You're like, you're in the family. And yet you're, I mean, it's like the dream that will never come true for most woke people.
God, I mean, but right. So I assume they sign to each other, right?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That I can do. That I'm comfortable. I'll sign I will never affect a deaf voice, except if I'm on a podcast trying to explain to, you know.
Yeah, do that some more. No, I'm just kidding.
Trying to explain to Thaddeus what I am talking about. It's so ruthless, man. I just made me so fucking uncomfortable.
Wow.
But anyway.
Yeah, you were humiliated by your mother.
Yes.
Speaking.
Yes, it was
public.
Very embarrassing growing up. A deaf voice is a challenge for a young hearing man. As a kid, that was like my primary goal, was just to make sure my mom never talked around any of my classroom. I mean, look, I'm already this white kid who's embarrassed about being white, and that, like you, I'm already like every mm-hmm. white kid, like sort of like, please, I just don't want to stick out. And then my mom comes and she's just like stomping around, talking with her like retarded sounding voice. And my whole life was just, I was just embarrassed all the time.
Oh, sure. Yeah. But she's also into therapy big time, as was my mother. My mother became a therapist. She was so into it. She went from Marx to Freud.
Uh-huh.
And so therapy filled the house. Like, that was what we talked about all the time. And there's a therapeutic sort of way of being. And I saw that in your childhood too,
yeah.
Right? You got put into a therapist office when you were little, right?
Yeah. Well, I started therapy when I was, as my dad got more and more religious and got closer and closer to the Godhead, my mother's Godhead was, you know, psychology,
yeah.
Straight up.
Yeah.
And my grandmother was a Jungian. She was a committed.
Oh.
She would say out loud, "I am a Jungian."
Oh, okay, yeah, we didn't deal with those people.
Okay,
we were psychoanalytic.
Yeah,
family, so, psychoanalytic family.
And she got out of an abusive marriage through therapy, and then my mother did the same thing, and then she threw me into therapy when I was 4 years old.
Yeah,
and I started going to therapy when I was 4 years old. And I was in therapy pretty consistently from the time I was 4 until I was 16. And by the time I was 16, I was in therapy literally 8 times a week.
Jesus.
8. That's more times than there are days. And you wonder how that's possible. I had, I remember I had like rehab after outpatient rehab 5 days a week.
Drug rehab,
mm-hmm. which was just a therapeutic
yep.
thing. And then I had group therapy 1 day a week, individual therapy 1 day a week, and family therapy 1 day a week during the day. And so I was foie gras therapy as a young
Jesus
duck.
Christ. Yeah, I was taken to a shrink when I was about 6, but they didn't stick with that. I didn't do therapy again until I was like 19. But yeah, when I was reading your memoir about this, So she puts you in therapy, and the way you tell it is that you were just a wild, out of control, angry child. And so you're sort of, in your own telling of it, almost justifying
her putting me in.
Yes. That. And you're kind of explaining why she did this. So then what happens in your own telling, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but like that you then become a delinquent. You start to do shit like set things on fire and steal stuff and skip school and join this Wigger gang and all that. But you know, you're really like straight up delinquent. You're doing terribly in school and you have all these, and you start doing drugs. It's almost as if the therapy became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's the great question of one of the yeah. questions of the book is like, was I being sent to therapy at that young of an age because my mother saw within me the glimmer of delinquency and problematics that mm-hmm. that was latent and obviously existent? Or did she turn me into this wild kid by just being in therapy and having somebody tell me that I was a problem from the time I was 4 years old?
Yeah. You became convinced early on that you did have a problem Right.
I definitely felt like the identified patient. And in fact, I could have said to you the words, "I feel like the identified patient." That's how savvy a therapeutic user I was.
So I did terribly in school, and I was actually tracked into remedial English in high school. I'm now the author of 3 books.
Sure.
Right. And so you were tracked not just into remedial English, you were tracked into special education.
Yeah. So, right. And in a weird way, that is a kind of a rotten example of white privilege, right? It's like white privilege where the privilege path doesn't actually net you anything, right? So it's like, I really believe that with the behavior that I had at that time, and maybe I'm just saying it's why I don't actually know for sure, but basically, because it also had to do with my mother's worship of therapy. I mean, she fucking worshiped therapy like a religion.
Mine too.
It would be, I would be in an argument with my mom, and it would be like, you know, the sky is blue. And I would say, and she would say, no way, the sky's green. And I'd say, no, it's blue. And she'd be like, no, it's green. I'd be like, it's blue. And she'd be like, okay, let's ask the therapist. And then the therapist would be like, the sky's blue, of course. And then my mom would go, oh, okay, cool, it's blue. So it felt like I couldn't tell my mom anything, but the therapist, anything they said would become the ultimate truth. So my mom's worship of therapy led me to, when I started having real behavioral problems, not just like getting sent there, to getting, you know, you could get tracked. This is the white privilege part. Yep. It's like the behavior problems I had, most kids, especially black kids, would have been school to prison pipeline. Yep. They would have been diverted into the criminal justice system because I was wild at a certain point, like truly out of control, criminal, violent teen. So they could have sent me to juvenile hall, then a CYA, California Youth Authority, then to, you know, prison, then to real, you know, then to adolescent prison, then to real prison. But I got tracked into, maybe thankfully, maybe not, was, you know, I got sent to, rather than getting sent to detention, which is the beginning, I got sent to special ed classes, which was the beginning for me. And then the next was like an increasing level of special ed classes, then a special ed school, then a mental health facility, then a rehab, and then on. And then I got lost in the special education system, the IEP system, which is, once you have an IEP, do you know what that is?
No.
It's an individual education plan for special education. And once you're in that IEP system, it means that the state has come in and made a special ed plan for you. And at a certain point, it's exactly like being having a criminal record. You just have a mental health, you know, record, and you get sent further and further down this spiraling ladder of increasing levels of insanity, retardation, literal retardation, and not me, but like increasing amounts of people around me in the classroom that were like literally mentally retarded. And then at a certain point, when there's so many retarded people around you, you have to ask yourself, am I positive I'm not retarded?
That's what I'm saying here. Yeah. So what did, first of all, what did your mother have to say about you being put into special education?
My mother was frantically attempting, and, you know, the most charitable interpretation of it for my mom is that she was frantically attempting to find the correct educational modality that would pull me out of my delinquent circumstances. All in her mind, all it was I hadn't hit the right therapeutic model. I hadn't hit the right educational model. I hadn't taken the right psychiatric medication. And if we got the elements right, I would then straighten up and fly right.
But the state of California, am I right? Said essentially that you are retarded.
They didn't call me retarded. They called me,
well, they put you on a short bus, literally.
They did put me on a short bus.
They put you in the special ed classes, literally. And almost every other kid was actually retarded.
That is true. But yes, they said that I was learning disabled, and maybe I was. I have no idea that I was psychiatrically something, depressed, oppositional defiant disorder, conduct disorder. Oppositional defiant disorder and conduct disorder these are the precursors.
Fuck those people.
Fuck those people, indeed. I agree.
They did that to you.
No, I totally agree with you.
I mean, they did bad shit to me, but nothing like that.
It is really bad, and my mom is complicit in it, for sure. My mom isn't blameless in that.
I mean, Moshe, come on. Look at yourself. Listen to you talk. You went to UC Santa Barbara. You're a fucking genius. It's obvious. And you're very verbal.
I'm the world's first retarded genius.
You are. Rain Man or something.
But no,
And you're very, very verbal, and you've done extensive reading. And I mean, give me a... they labeled you. They put me in remedial English, and they labeled you retarded. They did.
Don't think that I am defending them. I'm not. What happened to me was very monstrous, and I consider it an ultimate example of being lost in the system. Basically, once you... The school systems are so... they're so codified that once they put you in that IEP system, it's very difficult to get out. And every behavior issue that you have. So like, you know, you get transferred into this IEP thing, and then you go, fuck this. I'm not that. And they go, did you say fuck this?
Mm-hmm.
Ah, behavior problem. A little further step down.
Sure.
And then you're like punching the wall because you're mad to be there. And it's, oh, did you punch the wall? Another further step down, until where I found myself was the worst place I found myself was at a place called Seneca Center for the Severely Emotionally Disturbed Youngster.
Jesus.
And that was a truly scary, truly awful place, which was that nobody there was quite retarded. They were literally... psychopaths.
Where was this?
This was in Fremont, California. Okay, yeah. And these kids were psychopaths. I mean, I would be surprised if no one in that school has killed someone by this time. And I mean, I'm sure
they put you in there.
Padded cell in the back of the, literally a padded cell in the back of the classroom.
Right.
And if you spoke without being called upon, you had to put your face up against the wall and stand there for 10 minutes silently. And they would put you in a padded cell if you were, this is the reality I found myself in. Loss. And by the way, I wasn't thinking I belonged there. I knew full well that I had been, it was like a, being, you know, in an insane asylum because you're a foreigner, you know, like you go to like Spain and they think like, oh, this guy's a feral guy because he doesn't speak Spanish. Like, no, I promise. I'm smart. I'm capable. I'm not this. But there I was nonetheless. So no, I don't think it was cool what happened to me. It was fucked up.
A little less than cool. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yes, that's exactly.
How did you feel when you saw that movie or read the book?
I never really ported that experience over to me. But, you know, the difference between One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and me is that Jack Nicholson's character, whatever the character's name is in the book, he decided to do it. He thought he was gaming the system. I was literally like trapped and didn't want to be there and embarrassed and humiliated. And by the way, I was still being this like cool, like Wigger boy back at home. So like I literally would have the short, but literally drop me off a block and a half away from my house so that nobody would see me walking back. And then I would walk back all cool and shit, you know, like with my little pimp swagger, hoping that, you know, I mean, it was, those were rough times.
Yeah. So you're black, you're white, you're Jewish, you're not Jewish.
You're deaf.
You're deaf, not deaf. You're crazy. You're not crazy. You're a psychopath. You're not a psychopath, right? Man, liminality.
Yeah.
Through and through.
I was never, that is very true. I mean, that is really who I was. It was always about living between worlds and belonging in neither.
Let me add another one. Smart and not smart.
Yeah.
Right?
For sure. And that one was probably the one I believed the most.
It's more than that. It's very smart and very not smart.
Yeah.
You're retarded and operating at an extremely high level because you're an intellectual and, you know, your brother's an intellectual, your parents were intellectuals essentially, right?
Yeah.
I mean, people of the mind of ideas, but you're also retarded.
It is a life that I wouldn't wish on anybody else, but it definitely is also a life I would never have... I'm very glad I had.
I mean, so for me, I had a lot of that stuff and not quite to the degree you did. But so one of the effects of it for me, and I'm still getting over it, is always feeling homeless in a way, like fundamentally, you know, even if I have an actual house and even I've had like my own family in that house.
Yeah.
I always felt kind of homeless. So like I'd be walking around New York when I had a wife and a kid at home. If it was like a rainy, depressing day, the feeling I would have of sadness was that I was literally a homeless person in that moment. Like it would come right to me.
Wow.
It was like the default feeling. And I think, I don't know, but I think it's because I was always between two worlds too.
That's really,
I don't know. Have you ever felt that way?
That's not a feeling that I relate to. Although when you say it, it kind of like touches a part of me. Actually like a sweet sentiment. I mean, the effects for me, you know, it's really complicated for me to think about emotionally, like what part of it still lives with me, you know, because part of my story, my grander story, is like feeling so fractured. You know, it sounds very lofty to call it liminal, you know, because what I felt like was shattered into a million pieces and none of them could occupy any of those spaces adequately.
Right.
So, you know, you could look at it from one angle and say, oh, here's a guy that lives in all these worlds. But for me, it more felt like I live in none of them.
Exactly.
Right. I can't get a foothold in any of them. And, you know, the black thing always was like, I mean, it's not even really a black thing. It's like, I wanted power, you know? That's what blackness meant to me.
Yeah, that's,
you know?
Isn't that funny? Right?
Exactly.
You become socially powerful if you're black, right?
Exactly.
See, this is the thing. It's all about context.
Yeah, exactly. I wanted to be tough and I wanted to be big and bold and popular and cool and, you know, and what I meant by blackness wasn't even really blackness. I mean, I didn't mean blackness. I meant like, you know, gangster. Like, that's what I meant. That's not what it means to be black. Black people aren't gangsters. No,
it's a form of blackness, right?
Sure. It's within the urban hip-hop, you know, cultural milieu. But really what I meant was like I wanted to be Scarface. I remember I had this poster of Scarface on my wall because like, now there's a powerful guy. Now that's the guy. All he has in his world in the world is his word and his balls, and he'll shoot anyone. But like, he dies in a pile of cocaine. Like, it doesn't end well for
Scarface. Not the rapper Scarface. You mean
I
the
wish
movie, the movie character, right?
Yeah.
And Too Short was your guy.
Too Short
he was Oakland. He was the king of Oakland rap then.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, here's a guy who's just saying, I've never loved a woman. I'll never love a woman. I mean, can you get more transparent? You know, it's like I'm talking, I think we're talking about my mom, right? We must be talking about my mom. I remember I went on a date with a girl once and we were early in the date. We go, I was like, something, your dad. And she goes, my dad died when I was 12. I wish he died when I was 9, the piece of shit. And I was like, okay. And then a little later that evening when we were making passionate love, she was talking to me like this, literally. She was like in the Muppet baby voice. She was going, oh, daddy. Oh. I was like, could you hide your psychological issues like one layer further under the sentimental rock? I actually had to, the first time I've ever had to say, actually, that's not working for me. You're gonna have to talk dirty to me in a different way because I'm not enjoying this right now. At any rate, my point is, and I hope that the listeners really love that little act out that I just did.
It reminded me of something.
Yes,
go ahead, keep going.
Yeah. No, my point is, what I was shattered, and then you know I went into recovery. I'm not even in recovery anymore. I mean, technically. I mean, I'm still sober, and I've been sober since I was 16, but like...
Since you were 16.
Yeah, 15, actually. Just about to turn 16.
Yeah, I also wonder about that, but keep going.
I wonder about that.
In AA meetings that I've been to, there have been people like that, you know, who were like in their 30s, and they said the same thing. I've been sober since I was 16. I was like, wait a minute. How can you be an alcoholic
I'm happy.
If you haven't had a drink since you were 16?
Yeah, now you're touching on my primary existential crisis of these days, but I'm happy to talk about that too. But regardless of the truth of whether I belonged in AA at that time or not, the truth is, all those shattered pieces, what AA does really well is that it takes your shattered pile of shards and it recreates this new fortified version of a person. And so now... who I am today, and this is, I haven't been to a meeting in probably 7 years. I mean, it's just not who I am anymore, but I have this like real experience of taking all of these like sort of shattered experiences and kind of like recreating myself, whether it was an illusion or not, but like I recreated myself into this much more confident, much more me type of person. And I really feel like I buried a lot of that like deepest trauma that, like that engine that drives you, that trauma engine that drives you, like your homelessness, but you maybe you're more integrated. So you go, I know that I feel homeless. I sometimes feel like I don't even know what parts of the trauma of my childhood are still left animating me because I just feel so animated that I'm not paying attention to the parts of the engine.
Yeah, engine, jet engine. That's what you were.
That's
when
right.
When I first met you.
Back to the beginning.
There is a force. And the other thing I told you before the mics, we started the mics, is that your act, that you, I wouldn't say you play a character, but there is a Moshe Kasher character, I think.
Sure.
Yeah. And you agreed with me, like in your stand up, there's a performance, there's an acting going on. You're very physical, by the way. At quick side thing on that, by the way, and Jewishness. So the other thing you reference in your act in that set, being a French mime, like a French mime, which I see that too.
I look like a French.
You look like it. Sure, I get that. And you move like it a little bit. Sure. But actually, what I saw more was vaudeville.
Oh, yeah. I like that. I cannot complain about
and
that.
And so here's another liminality. You're between old Jew and new Jew, too. Because the new Jewish comics don't move their bodies. I mean, I'm talking about since the 1940s, right? They just stand still and tell amazing, they're phenomenal comics, but right, I can't think of another Jewish comic who moves their bodies.
That's interesting. I thought you were going to say, but I like what you're saying. I thought you were going to say that also, I am an old Jew and a new Jew. I am this sort of like, I have had people come up to me, like Elon Gold is he's a comedian and an Orthodox Jew. And he's like, now you don't believe in God, right? You don't like Judaism. And I'm like, I never said any of that. I mean, I don't know if I do believe in God, but I'm not an irreligious or I'm not an anti-religious person at all. I have no animosity toward, you know, some people, they pop out of religiosity and they think never again, fuck these people. I don't have that feeling. I think that I have a sentiment that is so irreverent and I love making fun of Judaism. It's one of my favorite things to do, to literally melt the golden calf that is Judaism or that isn't.
Pretty much every anti-Semitic joke I've ever heard has come from a Jew.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, back to Larry David. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, like when I'm around Hasidic Jews, less and less as you know, the poison of Hasidic society becomes more and more apparent to the world. There's a lot of really really, really nasty parts of Hasidic society that really bother me.
Oh, God, yeah.
But mostly, when I'm around Hasidic Jews, culturally, I feel like, oh, these are my...
homies.
These are my people. They don't know that about me, and they certainly would not acknowledge it back, but... You know, my dad grew up. I grew up in a community of Satmar Hasidim. My dad remarried a woman that was a Satmar Hasid. Satmar, by the way, are some of the. This is an interesting story. My brother. Yes.
Go ahead. No. So yeah. More liminality. So you're also going between Oakland and Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Like in the summers, you were in
Brooklyn. 6 weeks a year, I would go to Brooklyn, and I would literally pretend to be a Hasidic Jew, not even really knowing the Hebrew alphabet. So everybody in the neighborhood spoke Yiddish as a first language. I don't even know, like, the ABCs in Hebrew. They're speaking to me in Yiddish. I'm just, like, answering back, like, ha, 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 so like, hoping.
This place, it wasn't just this Hasidic community. It was also in this very particular part of Brooklyn. Everybody should Google this Seagate. It's next to Coney Island. It's just this little point of land.
Here's how I describe
it. It's a private community. So you're really a world apart.
Again, I describe it in my act as like
bizarre.
If you take the F train to the last possible stop, you get off, you walk past Coney Island, past the projects, past the people of color, through a gate, through a time portal to pre-Nazi Europe. You'll then arrive in Seagate.
Old Jew.
Old Jews.
New Jew comes in. One of the most amazing scenes in your book is when your father, I think it's the first time you go there, takes you to the barber and he carves payas out of your haircut.
They were trying.
Jesus Christ. I mean, that's like the worst thing I could imagine doing to a child.
I mean, it was so, I didn't know... Like I said, like, yeah, it was bad, but he didn't know, and I don't know why I'm trying to absolve him, but, like, he didn't know, I didn't know, we all were, like, trying our best make
it wasn't
some...
malicious, it was just, yeah.
Definitely bad. I mean, it's such a bizarre world. I have cousins, this is true, I have cousins who are third generation American, or second generation American, their parents are Americans, they have Eastern European accents today, their parents don't.
Yeah.
So they're... Oh. So the immigrant grandparents come. They have Eastern European accents from Eastern Europe. And they tell the kid, because at the time, Jews are in a much more precarious situation, like, be like American.
Assimilated.
So the American parent is raised and then becomes, oh, wait, I belong here. I have power. So then they teach their kid Yiddish as a first language. So literally, my one uncle talks like an American. My cousin, Leibish, talks like straight up a dude from The Fiddler on the Roof. Now, that person, the uncle who talks like an American, was a fugitive from the law who ran to Brazil because he set his warehouse on fire for insurance money, as they call it, Jewish lightning. And
never heard that.
You never heard
another,
that?
Another anti-Semitic joke from a Jew.
Okay. I didn't make that one up. But in so this is the reality that I grew up in. It's like the moral arbiters are amoral. And you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The people that are looking down on us going, look at these like non-religious, irreligious, kind of like almost near goys are criminals. And we're the weird ones here.
Well, I mean, it's just true that they don't care about the rules outside their community.
It is true that delicately.
Yeah,
but it is true that many Hasidic communities are, that many Hasidic, not all, communities are more concerned with religious law than they are with civic law. Though, every religious, that is a bastardization. In the same way that it is true that some Muslims have interpreted the Quran to say it's okay to do terrorism, some amoral versions of Hasidic Judaism have interpreted breaking laws as like, who cares, because the only law that matters is the biblical law. But the reality is that every single sect of Hasidic Judaism says that it is a moral imperative to follow the law of the land in which you live. Whether people followed that moral imperative, that's a different story.
And how deeply they feel it, right? How deeply invested are they as Americans?
Well, also, Hasidic Judaism is very complicated because...
I mean, that was the core of the Nazi anti-Semitic ideology. That was the core claim, which wasn't, I'm saying, entirely false, right? It's like they were essentially stateless people. That's sort of the point of Jewish history, right?
Well, yeah.
Liminal people, by the way.
They're very liminal, definitely. But also, like, why would you believe in a state when every state you've ever lived lived in has killed you, oppressed you, poked you with pinchers and forced you
to... Oh, I'm on the Jews' side, of course. Yeah, I mean, I think being part of a state is the worst thing. Being a nationalist is terrible.
What? I agree. Yeah. But you want to talk about liminality created by trauma. There is no greater example than the Jews. I mean, I truly believe that any wart in Hasidic culture is as a result of being a multi-generationally traumatized people whose apex culminated in the Holocaust. The reason that Hasidic Jews today are such a people of other, it's not accidental. It's literally the direct response to the Holocaust. So the Hasidic Jews after World War II said to themselves, except for some sects that are more open, like the Chabad Lubavitch people, or they're much more involved in regular society. But the ones that are more closed off, they said to themselves, look, we just came from the Holocaust. It's obvious to me, to us and everyone else that the world is an unholy, evil, terrible place that only wants to kill Jews. Mm-hmm. Is that paranoid? Well, look back in Poland. They're all dead.
Sure.
So rather than try to be of the world, let's create a wall around our world and try to preserve the last shards of holiness in the world. Has that become sort of bastardized over the years? You'd be hard pressed to argue no. But I understand why they're like that.
I have tremendous respect, actually, for the ultra-Orthodox. And when I see these communities that seem to be very coherent, whole, they take care of each other, you're not going to have to worry about making a living, having housing. You know, it's, as far as I know, it's very successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, internally. And they've really pulled it off for many, many decades now.
Well, to make another link to earlier, I mean, the factors that are pushing any Hasidic Jewish community that is, like, you know, antisocial or difficult for Gentile or non-Jewish society to understand, or even openly hostile towards Gentile society, it's the exact same force that had us being held hostage on the playground or in the wet field. Mm-hmm. It is a misinterpretation of the anger that you feel a result of being victimized for generation after generation, to the degree that you can take a couple of white kids and say, kiss my shoes, and it feels like the right thing to do. This is our get back for slavery, motherfucker.
Yeah, it's just that, I mean, the Hasidim, at least the ones I've seen, I used to live in Brooklyn, you know, weren't doing aggressive anti-goy activities. They weren't holding kids, Gentile kids hostages.
Oh, we have different strategies for sure. Like, I don't know if you've studied some of the Hasidic communities up in upstate New York where they take over like the school boards.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah.
And it's all about like, let's just preserve what we want and fuck everybody else. Well, these are very antisocial decision making, and you know, you can't really justify it, but you can kind of wrap your brain around it. Like, well, I kind of understand the mentality of us, it's us or them, so let's make it about us.
Sure. Yeah. One more piece of liminality for you. I think you're okay with this because you actually reference it in your act, or at least in your special. So when I did that show with you, and that was like 5 or 6 years ago, I didn't even think about this one way or the other, because I read you, an academic would say, I read you as straight.
Yes.
And I also met your girlfriend at the time, who's now your wife, Natasha Leggero, backstage. I just didn't even think about it. I mean, but you, I never once, no gaydar went off at all.
Sure.
Right? And then also, by the way, like, once you got on stage, I thought it was actually more masculine than anything, sort of this taking control of the room, which, by the way, I don't know if you know this, that's how you describe your father. Your father, you said in the book that he takes control of every room took control of every room he went into.
So there we go. There's one of the responses of my childhood that I didn't even know were there. Yeah. Here I am. I'm just my daddy.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I thought about you. And then I read this in your book about your dad.
Fascinating.
It was interesting. But anyway, so I saw sort of a masculinity, if anything. But then a couple weeks ago, I'm watching your special with my girlfriend. And, you know, 3 minutes into it, I'm thinking, Moshe is really gay in this. And my girlfriend, I didn't say this, but my girlfriend said, is he straight? I said, he's straight. Yeah, he's married to a woman. And, you know, and then you reference it in the middle of that act.
Sure.
Where you say something, I forget how you put it, but it's sort of like, oh yeah, by the way, I'm straight. I know that's shocking to all of you.
And sure.
And there is, I don't even know what to do with that, even though I've like studied and thought about gender for decades. Like, if there's something that you're doing that is different. I will say this, though. One thing I do relate to, but again, you're more extreme than I am. I have always felt not entirely straight, always totally heterosexual, but not entirely straight. And I think it's probably what's going on with you. But the other thing I like to do and have always done is sort of play with being gay and being very fine, being comfortable with making fun of my own fagginess, right? And sort of when people call me a fag or whatever, I say thanks for the compliment,
right?
And always being very comfortable with that, which, you know, of course, is really subversive of masculinity and that whole central fear we all have of being called a fag. And it seems like that's what you're doing.
Well, yeah, I think
in part,
definitely. Yeah. I think that's definitely right. I think that it is actually much more about being so masculine that you're comfortable being feminine. That is a very Bay Area thing. It's like, I really do think it comes to that. It's like, it really isn't about like, I, because I kind of agree with you. I don't really think I read gay. I think that like the stage persona is a little bit more flamboyant than my real persona, but also like having had that stage persona, then having people make these assumptions about me, thinking that's so interesting and so funny as opposed to thinking that's so angering. I remember very clearly the joke that you're referencing in particular. There's a whole thing about how there's a bit on that in the special about how I got, I think it's on the special, about how I got gay bashed, but I didn't, but, and then the joke is I'm not gay, you know, and it wasn't real bashing. It was just literally a car full of people drove by and screamed at a group of us, you know, fags.
I had the same thing happen to me. Yeah.
And how the funny part to me was not only that, you know, it's funny that I'm not gay. So that my friend, or a guy I knew anyway, was so mad. He went crazy. Right. He's like, he screams at this car full of strangers who are already gone, right? He's just like, fuck you, come back here and say that shit to my face. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, why is this upsetting to you? They don't know you and they're gone. Like, it was such a funny, to me, the funny part was actually his response, not what the guys did. Because it's just, and so in the special, I think it's like they scream, they're like fags, and I like very flamboyantly and effeminately go, wrong guy, right? Like
right.
And it is a thing where I just, especially in my early development after I got out of AA and rehab and all these shattered realities, and I was trying to find my own real reality and my own real identity, was I started going to raves. Early in the 90s in San Francisco, and that was by definitely the primary social scene that I was in my whole young life.
A very gay scene,
pre-comedy, a very not only gay but forget gay, like a very
trans.
Like, we don't care,
right?
Everything is good, we love everything, and like the more effeminate the guy the better, and like sex everywhere, but who cares about, you know, like if you're masculine, like me, literally this is true, going from like wigger boy with you know this accent and like Fila caps and sagging my pants to, after my first rave, you know, very quickly getting seduced by that scene. I'm literally putting glitter on my face, putting barrettes in my hair, you know, because it was so seductive. I always talk about it like what I think what happened for my soul when I went to raves and really got sucked into it is that here I was, you know, ages 12, 13, 14. I'm trying to be like a criminal. I'm trying to be Scarface, right? In the time I'm supposed to be being a kid, I'm trying to be like a fucking gangster because I'm scared and I want power, you know? And there's very diminishing returns with being a gangster, you know? There's not a lot of happy old gangsters, you know? And so I was but that's such a hyper masculine thing.
Exactly.
I remember listening to Too Short and going, I remember I lost my virginity and, you know, I had sex with this girl and I threw her out. I the moment after we had sex, I was like, all right, you got to go. The reason I did that, I'm very ashamed that that is what I did, but I was also 14 years old. But the reason I did that is I was informed by gangster rap that that's what a man does. A man goes, now get out. Like, I was literally modeling my romantic behavior around gangster rap. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it couldn't be more aberrant and wrong, right? Mm-hmm. Wrong-headed. Wrong morally, just like incorrect. It's like, that's not the person you look to for like developmental
If you want to continue having sex with women.
I mean, I was just, right? But I actually thought like, well, that's what you do. Isn't that what you do? Like, cause also a kid and ingesting these messages. And so then, so that's such a hyper toxic form of masculinity, right?
Right.
Is gangster rap, sure, and gangsterism, that then I'm all the way over here. I'm miserable. I'm, you know, a drug addicted, weirdo, delinquent kid. I go into rehab. I kind of get sober. About 9 months later, I go to my first rave. And the pendulum swing of masculinity, yeah, is so, jeez, profound and pronounced. Like, literally, barrettes. Hug every man that you meet. You know, get a massage from a man.
Wearing,
like,
makeup.
Wear some makeup. You know, like, wear big, colorful clothes. Like, everyone is... And by the way, it's infantilized. You're wearing... Yep. You have pacifiers.
That's right.
And you have barrettes. And you have... I used to bring this stuffed gorilla puppet to raves when I was a new... You know, I'm like... All of a sudden, I'm grabbing this childhood that I should have had over here in a regular way, but it's been pushed a few years, and I'm grabbing this, like, non-masculine manhood that I should have had over here because my mom's this hippie. There's no modeling. I had no dad going, be macho, you know, kick girls out of bed. I never had that. I was raised by my mother and my grandmother, who are committed feminists, telling me, you know what I mean? Like, so then I go to raves, and I find just what I needed, you know, which is... I'm sure the reason that I loved raves so much, and I've never loved anything more in my life.
Really?
Clean and sober, by the way.
Wow.
No drugs.
Wow.
I just found there the most, like, profound experiences available to me, that probably even more profound than I found in AA, you know?
Which was what exactly? What did you find there?
I found... Oh, there's a story that I often tell about my first rave. Maybe this will illustrate it. I went to my first party. I don't know why I was drawn to it. I have no idea. I was 16, I was 9 months sober, and I was still a gangster, but I was sober, so I was trying to, like, change my life, and I bought a ticket to this party by myself. I was going alone.
Wow.
And I remember very clearly that I brought a bottle of Escape by Calvin Klein. Do you remember that cologne? Mm-hmm. And I stuffed it into a sock as a makeshift weapon, because my mentality... There's no one after me. There's no reason for a weapon. But, you know, my mentality is, you know, I got a little... It's like a blackjack, just in case I got to, like, swing the sock, the cologne sock around and thwap a motherfucker. You know, I'm not a big thwapper, but, like, that's like... You always got to be, you know, ready to thwap. A fragrant thwap. So that's my mentality that I enter the rave with. You know, the Escape is in the sock. I'm ready just in case some shit goes down, right? It's the end of the night. I walk into this big chamber in the Henry J. Kaiser Convention Center, and there's techno playing and people are dancing. And I mean, my mind got blown. I don't even know why. I don't know. I really do think it was about, like, my psychological thirst. You know, this was the sensitive, non-masculine oasis I've been looking for. Literally by the end of the night, the Escape bottle is on the ground. No one knows where it is. I'm straight up pirouetting. I mean, like, you know, I'm like dancing like a ballerina. There's this gay couple comes and they're like hugging me, and I'm like, I love you. And I'm having this like experience of like chrysalis, you know, in this rave. And that was literally the day that I left. I mean, it usually isn't that stark. I left gangsterism and that whole idea. In one moment, in one evening, in one event, I was now done, fully done, never to return to this, like, idea of myself as a tough guy, gangster. It was gone. And, okay, raver, that is a pretty absurd version of a person and a masculine and a man. And it's a pretty extreme, silly example. But God, it was therapeutic. It was exactly what the doctor... That was what the doctor ordered.
Wow.
Better than any therapy I've ever had in my life was that.
Yeah. So by that point, I was a professor, I think, or at least I was in graduate school in New York. But my students started to talk about raves, and I started to know about them. I was never...
It'd be 95.
Yeah. So yeah, I was in grad school. I started to hear about them, and it sounded to me like something that I should support, because it sounded like... My work, you know, is about stuff like this, about people like you, you know, people who transcend or move outside of cultural norms and find freedom, or they find something that makes them feel good. And to me, the reason one of the reasons I was attracted to black culture was that whiteness, being white, it always felt like a cage to me.
Mm-hmm.
Being straight has always felt like a cage to me. And and the body dancing, like that was what was most attractive to me about Black culture was the dancing.
Yeah.
Not just that they were quote good at it, but just that they did it. Right. Yeah. So white people just didn't allow themselves to dance. So I hear then in the 90s about these warehouses full of kids who are just dancing for 6, 8, 10 hours, and are sort of open emotionally. And no feelings apparently are shamed, right? And masculinity kind of doesn't even exist as a construct. It's sort of meaningless. And even yes. Femininity doesn't, right?
I think that's correct.
And the fact that it was sort of a modified disco beat and dancing was kind of that's the central activity, right? Absolutely. At a rave, right?
Yeah.
And that the child thing, right? So mm-hmm. like being an adult is a cage.
That's meaningless too.
Yeah. Being an adult is maybe the worst cage, and mm-hmm. you don't have kids, right? But like when you have kids, it really becomes like a double cage. And so, I thought, yeah, this might be the renegades of today.
Well, they were, and it's correct to say they were, because mm-hmm. I don't think that
it's gone now.
I just don't think that what it is now. I just sound like a curmudgeonly old person that used to be in a scene, because everybody who used to be in a scene is like it. But I do think that the outlaw, the essential outlaw, because literally they were outlaws in the beginning. Literally, there would just be like,
right.
they would be
That's
illegal.
Right. That was the other thing I liked about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. They were illegal.
That's right.
And now they aren't illegal. Now it's commercialized. Now, you know, DJs make millions of dollars a year rather than nothing and doing it strictly for the outlaw, the rending of society. There's a great image on the album cover of one of the early Prodigy albums. Prodigy, mm-hmm. you know, they're superstars now, but it's this great painting that really typifies the kind of the more punk rock spirit of the early rave. Is there's a painting on the inside of it, and there's this huge valley, this like gulf, and on one side of the valley is society, dark, smog filled. Fire, gross, and the police and the mayors and all the people with the pitchfork are running toward the other side of the valley, which is the rave. Literally, mm-hmm. there's just speaker set up. This is dark and overcast. This is sunny and bright and a meadow, green field of people dancing, thousands of people in a field with a DJ. And between the valley that the police are running toward is a single rope bridge connecting the two sides of the valley. And there's one mohawked raver with a knife flipping the police and everybody coming from that dark side off and about to cut the rope bridge so that the ravers can just party. And I think that really typifies what raves were about in the original days, and also in a weird way their eventual problem that made them not a cultural force that changed the world enough, is that if essentially the hippies
yeah.
wanted to change the world, and the ravers just wanted to dance, and all they really cared about was like partying in a way that was really nice, but also it wasn't sustainable, because it was just like, in the end, really, it was just about like, let's get into a field, which by itself is a subversive act and is valuable and useful, and taking ecstasy is good, and you mm-hmm. know, partying and opening your mind is good, but eventually it petered out in a way that the hippie movement didn't, because the hippie movement by its definition was like, no, let's get involved in the broader culture and change everything.
I think I differ with you on that. I mean, so there's obvious hippie references in rave. There's,
sure.
And also disco, by the way. So I've written about disco in the 70s, which was very similar in some ways. I mean,
it's
the sort of free space.
There's
right?
a direct, I just yeah. don't know if you, there's a sure. direct line from disco.
Oh yeah, well the music race. Obviously comes
yeah.
from, yeah, yeah. But
and the spirit.
And yeah,
sure.
and dancing. And
the gayness and the masculinity.
Right.
And the, I mean, actually house music, people say like disco died in the 70s, and it never died. It's almost a weird racist homophobic idea that yep. disco died. What yep. happened is they were forced to become house music because... Yeah. They did that disco sucks thing and because people were scared of black gay men sure. dancing and having a good time and influencing white culture. When yeah. ABBA came out, that was the end of that.
So I still I've argued publicly, I've written articles on this. You know, to me, disco was the most liberated and most interracial space in American history, potentially.
I'm with you.
And you see a lot all that in rave. So it's very much also a black, and I use this word very deliberately, queer space, yeah, right? Yeah. Because it's not gay. It's it's the gender bending, the sort of transgression of gender, you know, without insisting that everybody call me by the proper pronoun, you know, just pain in the ass. Well,
we
politics
weren't even
now.
There. We weren't even there yet.
That's what I'm saying. So you were in the place where it was just, we don't care about any rules.
Right.
What we're called, and we don't care what you call us. We're just going to go have fun with
each other.
With each other.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, man, I do think that's heaven for me, too. I mean, it reminds me of, like, dances I used to go to in college where it was very similar. It was just freedom. That is also the best moment of my life.
Yeah.
Spaces like that.
I mean, it was really powerful. I'm sure that... I wonder, you know, because now I look at, like, these parties that are, like, Electric Daisy Carnival sponsored by, like, you know, Beats by Dre and Heineken. And it's just like, I don't quite understand how that's possible, that could be. I'm sure people are having really nice experiences, but it just doesn't feel possible that without the danger and without the outlawness, that it could have that kind of experience.
I think being an outlaw is okay. To me, what's even better is that it's DIY.
Yeah.
It was all absolutely. Right. It was completely organic.
It didn't need to be illegal. I agree. Yeah. It was, you could have the right to throw the party as long as the party wasn't, you know, somehow like, oh, and here's the vendor. I mean, there were weird rules back then, too. Like, alcohol was, like, not acceptable.
Not cool.
Yep. Yeah. Right. And now everybody drinks at every party, but alcohol was out.
Yeah,
and so everybody was on drugs.
It's funny, this is the first time anyone's mentioned raves to me in a long, long, long time. It's just not around, and it's really forgotten. You know, we still talk about disco and hippies and stuff, but for some reason, you're right, it just got forgotten. And
it's not even that it's forgotten; it's that it's been it's been mainstreamized.
Well, okay,
it's been churned into mainstream society. So yeah, it's worse than forgotten. It's been it's been assimilated.
Yeah, so I'm really glad you brought that up because I want this to be in the public more. You know what those early raves were and what they represented. I have never been to one, but I am convinced, having heard you describe them and other people describe them, that politically, in the best sense, it's really what we should always remember. And for me, in terms of my values, what we I want to be pushing toward that.
I agree. And by the way, it is, I don't know about raves, but certainly electronic music is 100%. It's a black music form that has been forgotten about being a black music form. House music is obviously very direct from disco, but techno too was completely created by black people in Detroit in the ghetto who were just like tinkering with noise and trying to find, you know, way out of whatever their circumstances is. And it's like this weird thing where they created it and then no one in America cared about it. And then people in England, white people in England, heard about it.
Right.
And it was, there's this really interesting, there's a great documentary online called This Is House Music. It's really, it's on YouTube and it's really good. It's a BBC documentary where basically this guy, I can't remember who it was, maybe Steve Silk Hurley or Farley Jack Master Funk, one of the very early house music people who's making music in his like apartment in the projects and makes no money. Gets this call from his the label owner, like, hey, they want you to come to Manchester to play your music. And it's like, fucking this kid from the ghetto. Really? Oh, okay. And he goes to Manchester and it's a sold out show of people who know his music. I mean, it's like a Searching for Sugarman type of thing. Oh, yeah. Like they go and all of a sudden then in England they got this music and they created the rave. Yeah. And then the rave was then reintroduced to America. And then pushed across from New York to the West Coast to meet me in San Francisco in 1995 at that first party in this way that felt like, oh, it's a white thing. But in fact, if you go, because it went from England to Frankie Bones was the DJ that brought it from England back to New York and then back across the country. But in fact, it had been borrowed from American black culture in the first place. So it's this very complicated liminal situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, rock and roll had a very similar path too, right? So it's, you know, black blues basically, and then the black rock and roll stars of the 1950s, and then in again Northern England. This is a weird thing among these Northern English people. They just have always loved the shit out of black music, especially.
Maybe we should move there.
You ever seen like video of like dances in, you know, Yorkshire in the 1960s? I mean, they are getting down.
Yeah,
they're amazing.
Yeah.
And then of course it gets, and then comes back here with the Rolling Stones, right?
Right.
And then it becomes huge here. or huger here anyway. But yeah, no, I was thinking about, so let's move past this liminality shit. So, I mean, the rave to me, in a sense, I think this is right. What sets it apart is that there are no separations. There aren't divisions, or at least not, certainly not stark divisions like between male, female, body and mind, black, white, right? I mean, I think that may be part of what's going on there.
That is certainly true. I mean, look, nothing can truly exist devoid from the culture in mm-hmm. which it lives in. But yes, when you were in that warehouse, at least that's how it felt. It did not matter. If you were gay, it was unimportant. Mm-hmm. And if you were black, it was unimportant. If you were white, it was unimportant. It just, none of it was important. Nothing mattered but like being there and being together and the music and dancing. And that was it. It was just a bunch of bodies moving together. It did feel profound. I don't know if it was profound, but when we were there doing it, it felt profound.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt about that. I mean, you're heterosexual, right? At the time, aren't you?
Yes.
Right? Yeah, yeah. And, but also, I mean, the society would look at you, I'm sure, if they saw you and say, it's a gay kid. That's a gay kid.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And so you're moving, I'm sure, in ways that, quote, are gay, right?
In fact, I remember very
pirouettes, clearly, you said.
Yes, exactly. No, I remember very clearly my friend Joey, who you'll remember in the book, is the guy that passes away at the end of the book.
Is he the badass who
He's the
beats
badass.
Up yes, the giant,
exactly.
The black giant? Yeah.
So Joey came up to me, and Joey was, you know, a sweet kid that was trapped in the intellectual prison that we all were back then, right after I started going into raves, maybe 6 months in, and I'm pirouetting and I've eschewed gangster culture altogether, but I still know these people. And he comes up to me and he's like, "Hey, blood, man, people are saying you gay, blood." Mm. He's like, "You want me to beat their ass?" He offers to go beat people up.
That's
for saying that. And then how I knew I had moved on is I was like, no, Joey, I don't care if they say that. 6 months earlier, right, that would have given me an existential meltdown, right?
Right.
But here's my ambassador from the gangster culture telling me he's going to go beat up people for saying I've turned gay. And what they really mean is, like, he doesn't look like us and he's not miserable like us anymore. He's begun pirouetting. We need to do something about this.
Right.
And I'm just like, I'm so far past that. I don't. No, tell him I'm gay.
But how do you explain that? Why did you throw it off so easily, so quickly?
I do not know. I mean, I really think, I mean, I'm embarrassed to say that it, like, the power of the music, like, transformed me in that one night. But that seems like that's what happened. I mean, listen, what I really think it was that gangster culture, Oakland gangster culture, is unhealthy, straight up. It is just an unhealthy. It's not like I was, like, deciding between two fun scenes. You know, I was just thinking about this yesterday. Like, one of the things that we used to do is we would do what's called hitting licks, which meant that we would rob people and try to set these, like, elaborate robberies up, right? So that we could rob, like, dorks in the neighborhood. And I'm, like, thinking to myself, like, that was what we thought was, like, it was reinforced that was a cool thing to do. We had, I mean, I was poor, but I wasn't desperate. I had food and I had, you know, I mean, I guess we were poor, but, you know, we smoked pot when we wanted and I wasn't hungry. Yeah. So it wasn't like I was like, I must rob these.
Right.
I did it because it was cool.
Sure.
And I was thinking about that literally yesterday. It's like, that's the worst. There's nothing cool or fun or cool. That's just a negative, awful
thing. Nothing good about that. That's true.
So, so in a way, I was like walking through an arid wasteland, and then I got to, like, you know, Shangri-La. And of course, I was like, fuck this place.
Yeah.
I'm moving there.
No,
you don't buy it.
No, but you did something more radical that I was talking about, which is that you became very comfortable with doing things that are considered gay. That would be even being called gay, with moving your body in ways that are, quote, gay. You became totally comfortable with it.
Well,
and you still are, aren't you?
That's interesting.
And so that's weird, man.
That's interesting. There's two things. One is, I wonder, first of all, I never had any homophobia ever, even in my gangster years. So maybe that helped.
That's which is a big part of the gangsta culture. Right?
Yeah, but I was raised, luckily my mother raised me around enough gay people.
I think that's where it is. I think it's the women around you.
Yes, I think that is part of it. But yeah, my mom raised me around enough gay people that it just wasn't, and also I was in the Bay Area. It was just like, well, I don't think we were progressive around gay issues, but I certainly wasn't like a homophobe. But also, I think that, I think it's what I needed. I think that it was like I said, I think it filled in places that needed to be filled in. you know, the gay thing. I was so in, like, lost in this toxic masculine world. I feel you not believing that.
No. I'm thinking through this.
I wonder. I'm trying to think, too, like, how did I make such a quick switch? But I just really think I needed to be vulnerable. I needed that.
Here's what my shrink would probably say to you. That was the moment at that rave you went to when you were seen.
Yeah.
That until then, you were adopting guises. You were black this moment. You put on the black costume, then you put on the Jewish costume. You wore payas, and then you came back to Oakland. You wore the black costume. I don't know. I mean, maybe...
You know what else I think?
I don't know.
I think that, you know, I know we were moving past liminality, but I actually do think that the raves was the first thing that was ever totally mine. I went there by myself. Mm-hmm. It had nothing to do with anybody else. I wasn't adopting a culture around me. I wasn't being black. I wasn't being... I was just like, I discovered a scene and it belonged to me.
Were you a rave kid outside the clubs, outside the dances? I mean, when you were walking around, did you have... I mean, there's a rave look, right?
Oh, 100%.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yes, oh, yes.
Okay, so you are kind of still doing this thing. But 5, I guess you felt like that was more authentically you?
I'm just saying that I discovered it...
It was on your own.
...without any outside force saying, like, be this. I went into that. It was, you know, I mean, it was my punk rock. It was my, mm-hmm. it was my scene. In a way that being a gangster certainly never was. Obviously, being a Hasidic Jew certainly never was. Was like... The raves was like fully my thing, and the femininity stuff, I think part of it was just like culturally reinforced inside that world, was just like, it's not about being big and masculine, it's about being soft and loving. And by the way, sex in that scene immediately was just like, oh, if you're loving and respectful and cool, you... Everyone fucks in this scene. So it's like, it was immediately also like, you know, I got rewards immediately for acting like less of a pig. Was just like, you know, I went on a sexual exploration that, you know, was like, I mean, most 16-year-olds were not ready for such a thing.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that all you learned there served you well, right? Has served you well since then.
I absolutely...
I think in every way, including in your career. I mean, I think in your act and, you know, as in your comedy.
Definitely.
In your acting, by the way. I think I see that in acting, your acting. Wow. So yeah, the way I responded to this homelessness, liminality, whatever you want to call it, is knowing that I had to have a family, right? Because I didn't have a real family. That was always, to me, true. And also the thing that I felt to be the problem. So that's what I set out to do. And I found once I had a family that it wasn't the answer. But you did not do that, really. You're married now. Well, wait, you're married for the first time now?
Married for the first time.
Yeah.
I do have a kid on the way.
Oh, I didn't know this.
So hopefully this isn't going to be bad.
Ooh. Okay, cool.
I'm open.
Is this breaking news?
Yeah. No, it's not totally breaking news, but it is news.
But I mean, yeah, sure. But you're 38. You know, I'm not kidding you. I had dreams when I was 14 years old of having a family and kids.
Because that was home.
I wanted to have kids when I was 14 years old.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I take it you didn't have that.
I did not have that.
As a drive.
In fact, I'm not certain I have that today. Now. So we're a little past the point. So
yeah. Okay. Yeah. But so where did you find? I mean, you found it at the rave, but then you stopped being a rave kid pretty soon,
eventually,
right?
I would not say pretty soon. I would say I hung on for a while, but yes.
You went to UC Santa Barbara.
Went to UC Santa Barbara. Yeah.
Studied religious studies, right?
Mm-hmm.
What was that about?
I wanted to be an academic like you.
Yeah, no, I meant the major.
I wanted to teach Jewish history.
No, I know, but why?
Why?
You know what the shrink would say. I mean, I think you said this in the book. Your brother did this. Your brother's now a rabbi.
He definitely, it was definitely daddy, yeah.
Yeah, to please your dad.
Right? Maybe so. I love, but by the way.
I mean, that's the obvious pop psych analysis. I'm not saying it's right, but
right. I mean, in as much as any history that you have informs what you're going to do, but I really was fascinated with the Jews as a people and their story, and I still really am, because it's to me truly like, and maybe that's because of other parts of my history that, you know, it's reinforcing, but I just was really fascinated with this people that wandered endlessly in search for peace and couldn't find it anywhere they went. I mean, that's like you.
Oh.
You know, but I really like anti-Semitism was actually one of the primary like fascination points of Jewish history for me, which I really wanted to teach about and was really fascinated by. By the way, I never went into it because I eventually just realized, like, I'm just not an academic. It's just not who I am. I don't want to pore over tomes and write and publish. I just wanted to teach. I wanted to be on stage.
Me too.
Yeah.
No, that's why I did it. When I went to graduate school, I was pretty much, I thought, the only person there who was doing this just to teach. Mm-hmm. Turned out I did like to do research and write, but oh yeah, I just wanted to be a teacher.
Yeah.
So you didn't, it was the research part you didn't want to do, and the writing books.
It's just, I eventually realized, like, as much as I loved it, like, it just wasn't what I was going to end up doing. And also, you know, I think really comedy started to seduce me later in my college years. Comedy started to kind of like reveal itself to me as like a thing to do, which, by the way, comedy in a weird way is, it took the raver, sensitive, soft boy in me. And comedy's not, I would not say nourishing or reinforcing to the softness.
Oh my God, no.
It makes you harder.
Yeah, I mean, that's also where you, I think you're, I don't know how to describe you, but like, you're not, there is this sort of masculine thing in stand-up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't, you kind of do that and you kind of don't. You kind of, again, you're playing between the two worlds, right?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there is an aggressiveness, I think, about
big
your
time.
Act.
Yes.
But at the same time, you're like, every other word practically is you pointing out your own vulnerabilities.
That is exactly it. Yeah. Yeah. I describe my comedy, since we're talking about straddling worlds, mm-hmm. as highbrow, lowbrow as well. This is a different
thing,
but it is.
Oh, yeah,
truly,
that's right.
It's not only aggressive and also self-deprecating, but it's also like stupid and smart at the same time. I mean, very much by design, or that's what is funny to me. It's very funny to me to be hyper literate, but be talking about like really vulgar, really low kind of topics, and vice versa, talking about low topics in these sort of like, or rather talking about highfalutin topics in very stupid terms. Like, I love that.
It's also who you've always been.
That is right.
Always.
Yeah. Yeah. And I describe myself that way, and that's what I love. I love doing that. And I like, you know, Proops was on the first night we met. Like, Proops is a guy who's highbrow, kind of, mm-hmm. you know, like, mm-hmm. he kind of stays at the highbrow level. And I, you know, the first time I saw Proops, somebody was like, you really remind me of Greg Proops. And I saw him and I was like, oh, interesting. He's like the almost the adult version of me, you know, like, I'm like him, but like, from Oakland, and like the nastier kind of more immature version of him in a way that I like. I don't even say that as a bad thing, but I do think that comedy has this way of taking away innocence because of its process. The way that you write comedy is that you look at the world. In fact, I have a joke about it.
And it goes,
you know, you the process of comedy is that you're looking at the world, you're trying to like deconstruct it and find the absurd, the stupid, the idiotic, right? Which is the opposite of what raves are, right? And with raves, you're going into a warehouse and you're turning it into a sublime space, right? You're going into the ugliest place on earth, right? A warehouse. Mm-hmm. And you just set up speakers and you set up some lights and you bring people in and it becomes a church, right?
Mm-hmm.
And comedy's very much the opposite. You know, you go into the world and you just go, what's stupid? What's absurd? What's ridiculous? What's insane? Let me talk about that. Twist it, you know, magnify it. Make a joke about it. Tell it to the people. They laugh. You cry. That's the agreement. That's what I say in the joke. And I go, now over time, now we're actually into material. Over time, that kind of negative colored glasses will really turn you into a worse person. You know, as you aggregate the world for bad, you'll become worse. I'll give you an example from my personal life. When I first started comedy, I didn't like Holocaust jokes. This is true. I did not tell them. I didn't laugh at them. I didn't think they were funny. Fast forward 5 years, I made my Comedy Central debut doing a Holocaust joke on TV, right? Fast forward 5 more years, I systematically exterminated my entire family. So you see, there'd been a real downgrade. At any rate, the joke is irreverent, but the sentiment I really believe in is like, comedy can be, if you're not careful, very destructive to the innocence and the softness. Because of it, its process.
Yeah, that's a brilliant analysis of, in comparing raves with comedy. I'd never thought of it that way. Totally brilliant. I mean, it's like, I guess it's there's a door between you and the good stuff in the world. And the comic will just stare at the door and tell you all about the door. Mm-hmm. And he'll be right. Mm-hmm. And he'll tell you about what's good that you're missing out on and how your life sucks. And it's all correct.
Yeah.
And you'll even see those things in a new way. Thank you for that. The ravers, I guess, they just simply open the door and walk in.
They're already in there, right?
Yeah.
Right. They open the doors to perception.
Yeah.
Well, you know the old Pagliacci story, right?
Mm-mm, maybe.
I'm sure you do. This guy goes to a doctor, you know, and he's like, "Doc, I'm miserable. I'm sad. I don't feel like getting up in the morning. I want to die. My life sucks. My life sucks. What do I do?" And the doctor says, "Ugh, this is very simple. All you got to do, there's this amazing clown in town. Pagliacci's in town. Pagliacci, the great clown. He'll make you forget about your troubles. He'll make you smile. He'll make you happy. Everything will be great." And the doctor looks down and the guy's crying. He's like, "Why are you crying?" And the guy goes, "I'm Pagliacci." It's a little overly prescriptive for comedians, but there's some truth to it.
When I think about doing stand-up, I mean, I've never considered doing it, but like just the anxiety. And I've heard lots of stand-ups talk about it, like just the anxiety about lots of stuff, not just about getting up on stage and bombing, about being criticized for every single thing you do, but also just fill in the book, man. Like get in the dates.
That's... Oh, you mean getting work?
Yeah.
Oh, the bigger anxiety is filling the time, writing the material, continuing to generate and be funny and be as funny as your last thing and write. Where's the material? The material. That's the biggest anxiety to me. Then there's the work. Then there's the... Yes, I mean, earlier I was saying like I don't really believe that college crowds are uptight. That's not what I mean. Everybody's uptight.
Yeah.
And you're terrified as a comedian at all. And I think social media makes it worse because it's much worse to tweet something than to just say, "Here I am on stage saying it." It's much more empowering and there's much less for people to, you know, if I make a joke on stage and somebody goes, "That was problematic." It's like, well, fuck you, because it was clearly what I meant. When I put it out in the world as a little widget of text, then it becomes its own strange life out in the world that people can go like, you know, they can deconstruct what it meant. Like, there's jokes in my special that I wouldn't make now, but do I care? Am I worried that somebody's going to, you know, shine a light on him? I don't give a fuck. I don't give a fuck about any of that. I'm just trying to make people laugh. And I think, like, that's the great thing that has changed about comedy in the last 10 years, and I don't like it, is that it somehow has become a de facto reality that people believe that the comedian is supposed to be a social deconstructor looking for justice in the world. That's not true. Some comedians are like that. Mm-hmm. I'm certainly not. That's not my comedy at all. I'm like, there's no more superior comedian. Lenny Bruce is not a superior comedian to Steve Martin. They are different comedians. Mm-hmm. Lenny Bruce was talking about society. Steve Martin was talking about being a wild and crazy guy. Their jobs are the same, is to make you forget about your problems and laugh and have a good time. You know, like Patrice O'Neill, a very great comedian who passed away a few years ago, and probably the most problematic human being ever.
Yeah.
I mean, the most misogynistic, just beyond, but so funny that the best experience was watching Patrice perform in San Francisco at the Punchline to a crowd of, you would assume, probably mostly feminist women. And some of them would leave immediately. But then the ones that stayed, he was just so good, mm-hmm. that they would laugh despite themselves. And it was like... It was a very funny thing that he would always say, he'd be on these like panel shows, these Fox and Friends shows. People are like, "Whose side are you on?" He'd go, "Oh, I'm on the side of funny." And I think that should always be the comedian's goal for me. I mean, this whole idea of like punching up, like, I don't know what that means. Somebody made that up. I don't give a fuck about punching up. I care about making people laugh. I don't care about like getting to the truth. If you're a getting to the truth comedian, that's cool too, but that ain't me. I'm just trying to make like I always say, if you care more about justice than about comedy, you're not a comedian. You are a clever activist, which is okay. You can be a clever activist,
right.
But I'm not.
Yeah, you're a lecturer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of what I was doing that night when I was surrounded by you guys on that stage.
That was a good episode, though, by the way. It was very funny.
I loved it. But I knew, I said to myself right away, don't even try to be funny. You know, just not, even if I were funny, if I got lucky and were funny, it still wouldn't be as funny as you guys and it would just look bad. But last question. So, you know, you're also, as a comedian, you're supposed to be miserable, right? That's sort of the classic image. I mean, Louis C.K. has kind of really popularized that idea, sure, of the miserable comedian who ends up killing himself on the road. You know, I think about these guys sort of like going you know, living and staying in motels in Columbus, Ohio, and being on a bus and you know, good God.
I remember Mark Maron and Doug Benson were on a podcast together at this comedy festival. And it was so funny because they're both successful. Mm. And these are successful comedians.
Yeah, right.
And they were going, somebody brought up like the Residence Inn in Columbus or whatever city it was. And they were like, oh, that place has a great waffle maker. Yeah. The waffle maker. That, and it was just so funny. I'm like, this is the good case scenario. Like, these guys they're thriving. So, yes.
I've heard Maren talk about that. Like, he knows all the comedians know the best breakfast hotels, you know.
So funny.
So, you don't seem miserable.
I have fought very hard never to let myself be seduced by the illusion that comedians are supposed to be unhappy. I think that's a toxic, self-fulfilling bullshit prophecy that, listen, I can swing towards misanthropy as much as the next guy, but it's just like, it's such bullshit that comedians are miserable. It's just like, who made that up? I don't know what that, I mean, yeah, will strange circumstances make you funnier? Probably, definitely, mm-hmm. obviously, mm-hmm. you know, but do you have to be miserable? No, but you do have to fight. You do have to really like make sure that you don't allow yourself to give into that stuff. I mean, I think comedians in a weird way are lucky, like, this whole Harvey Weinstein thing really has made me look at how truly toxically disgusting the Hollywood system is. Like, in a way that I already knew, obviously we all kind of know it's all vapid and shallow, and like the politics of Hollywood is just like this like self-congratulatory, like, you know, just like succubus of like people sucking their own dicks about how progressive they've been, and like rap videos for Hillary that never, you know what I mean, like like you're out there just like Hilla Hilla Hillary, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, how interesting that no one responded to that and Donald Trump became president when that was your greatest offering. But then people thinking that what they're doing great work, but what they're really doing is trying to make money off of pretending to do great work.
Right.
At least the comedian is like somebody who's like some sort of other. I'm not a big person in like the nobility of the comedian. A lot of people like that too, like the philosopher king that stands alone. But at least like we have a little community that enforces saying what you mean and enforces being genuine.
I hope so. I mean, I know you do now. I'm worried about that, you know.
You mean that it'll go away?
Well, you know, this is being talked about, right? That comedy is now declining because of political correctness and people's fear of...
I've heard that.
...getting criticized and...
Where is the comedy that has declined? Because from my perspective, I'm watching it and I'm going, the biggest comedians, and some of the biggest comedians in the world right now, like Louis C.K., Bill Burr, Joe Rogan. Hmm. These are not people who seem to have been
censoring
chastised by the woke, outraged masses. Is outraged culture declining society as a whole? Of course. People are scared to outrage people. Absolutely. On every strata. But when people talk about, you know, although I thought that was very funny when Mel Brooks said PC culture is ruining comedy. It was like so funny to me because it's like, A, you're 90, you know, like, well, how do you know? What are you talking about? Like, the guy's a legend, but it's like, well, you have your finger on the pulse of, like, contemporary comedy. You're like, it's actually gotten a little bit worse. It's like, he's a 90-year-old man. I tweeted that, by the way, and people go, this was the funniest example of outrage culture just eating its own tail. I tweeted that. I was like, how interesting that a 90-year-old man doesn't have his finger on the pulse of contemporary comedy. You know, a guy that started comedy before the credit card was invented. Literally true.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And people are like, you motherfucker, that's ageist. And I'm like, wait, I'm sorry. You're outraged about me making a joke about Mel Brooks saying that people getting outraged is ruining, like, this is just too perfect. Like, I don't know that outrage culture is ruining comedy any more than it's ruining anything else. Comedy's greatest power is its commitment to free thinking, free speech, saying what you want. And I have had to adjust the topics and the way that I broach certain topics based on the way that that crowds react. Mm-hmm. That's just the reality. It's like, I don't know if PC culture is ruining comedy. I just know that like I can personally get away with a little bit less indulgence. I'll give you a great example. Faggot.
Yeah. Good
Thank
word.
You so much. That anyway, it's really nice coming on your podcast. And then I leave and that's the end. No, faggot used to be this great comedy word, right? That like a person like me could always say faggot because you could know inherently based on my character and the topics that I've broached that I don't mean it, right? So when I say it, and I'm especially when I'm talking about someone calling me that, it's like, you know, whenever I'm like, I am the faggot, I will always get a great big laugh, right? And for many years, that was just true, you know, especially because every time I said it, I was talking about somebody calling me that.
Yeah, you're critiquing homophobia, in fact.
I was critiquing homophobia.
Right.
Right. So, okay. So that happened and that was fun and we had some fun. Then at a certain point, you just felt the ground shift and it just didn't work anymore. It's just like people would not, they wouldn't laugh. They would in fact go like, ooh, they would feel uncomfortable. Now, you know, okay, the word nigger is the same way, right? It's like, you just can't say it. It doesn't matter if you're saying it on the right side because it just has this like resonance that makes people go like, we're not doing that. The only real place for it is in a discussion where you're deconstructing the actual word.
But it's not
and
allowed,
even there,
it's not allowed there either.
Fair enough. It's barely,
no, it's
barely
not.
Allowed. Right. Okay, fair enough. But it has a radioactive response. So that didn't used to be true of faggot. And now is true of faggot. So what do I do? Do I just keep saying it and like try to create a fan base that will, it was like, yeah, you fucking saying it, even though you can, society doesn't laugh at it, we fucking do, and we'll come out and support you. And then it becomes its own weird thing where they're just like, say faggot. And you're like, no, I'm doing a different bit. No, we're here for faggot. It's like, okay, well, I'm all right, faggot. Yeah, he did it. He melted the golden calf. Well, okay. So I just can't quite say it anymore, and it's too bad for my act. It actually is too bad for my act.
Especially for you.
But yeah. I think it's better for the world that we've moved past that word being able to be like bandied about like with impunity. Now, I know you're a guy that is a free speecher, and I actually remember from our podcast taping that you were dropping hard N bombs. Not as a slur, but as an honest deconstruction of the of the word itself. And I do understand that when you can overly empower words, but also you can overly under empower words or whatever, you know, where you're calling someone a faggot in a way that isn't, because it's not always going to be the guy that you trust to be the ally. It won't. Sometimes it'll be a guy who's like really on the border, or sometimes it'll just be a guy just like saying it because he thinks it's funny. And I guess I do think that that's probably better for the world. Disagree?
I don't know, actually. I really don't know. I lean against that argument, but I can't. I'm just not sure. So, yeah, I used nigger in my classrooms until about 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And that's unthinkable now.
Right.
In my own classrooms. I can't even imagine doing that now.
I think what I don't like is like you're reading a book and there's a passage in the book where there's like, you know, some racist is saying, you know, and, you know, we have to stop these niggers, and you're supposed to say, and then he said the grand wizard said we have to stop these N-words. It's like, all right, can you not do that? What do you do in a classroom in that situation?
No, then I read it. But a lot of teachers don't.
Uh-huh.
A lot of professors don't. You know, they rewrote, some publisher in the South actually published Huckleberry Finn and took out all.
I heard about that.
I mean, no, it's a problem.
Neil Brennan has a great joke about a guy that goes to a bookstore and he's like, hey man, I'd like that Huckleberry Finn with the N-words, please.
Black market Huckleberry Finn, so to speak.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying. Yeah. I think there's a danger in either direction.
Well, I mean, the thing I guess that I certainly don't like is the infantilization that goes on with this. It's
we're
fucking adults, right? Say the word.
Yeah.
This is what you do to children. You don't say the scary word to them. You spell it out. I don't know. It's a mess out there.
Let's get to the bottom of it right now.
Okay.
I think we can solve it in this podcast.
Let's do this.
We should just scream the N-word and faggot for the next 30 minutes.
One,
see.
Two.
Yeah.
If you want to support this show, there are two ways to do it. You can make a simple donation by going to ThaddeusRussell.com/podcast, or you can become a supporting listener of the show and a member of the unregistered community by going to unregisteredunderground.com. When you become a supporting listener, you'll become a member of a private Facebook group where every single day we talk and argue about the issues and ideas from the episodes of the show. You'll also get discounts on Renegade University videos and courses, including the upcoming webinar on postmodernism, and on our new unregistered merchandise. Again, to become a supporting member of the unregistered community, please go to unregisteredunderground.com. This was the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell.